From the Southeast Asian capital city of the Philippine Islands, 7,107 islands strong, Manila, I'm Art Bell, and howdy, everybody. This is Coast to Coast AM, the very largest program of its type in the world, and I am proud to be escorting you, honored to be escorting you throughout the weekend. It's going to be a very, very, very good weekend indeed, so just sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. I've got a couple of things right off the bat for you. Number one, my webcam shot. Now, how do you get to that? Every weekend, I get all kinds of inquiries about, hey, Art, you keep talking about these pictures. How do I get to them? You go to coasttocoastam.com, and in the upper left-hand side there, you will see Art's webcam. All you need to do is click on that, and you will see whatever the latest is that I put up. In this case, it is a picture of Erin, my wife, who I, and I put that up, I might add, just a very little while ago. That was taken in Hong Kong. As you know, we took a trip to Hong Kong. And so what's in the background? That was taken on Victoria Peak, which overlooks Hong Kong. Just an absolutely spectacular city. And we had a pretty good day. It was the second day after a rainstorm. And so that's a clear shot, believe it or not. For Hong Kong, that's fairly clear. And I'll try and get some others up for you. But that's a shot of Hong Kong when we were there a couple weeks ago. Now, before I dive into the world news, some of which is, I think, humorous for a change. Well, not really, but I see humor in it. I guess I see humor in a lot of things, except what I'm about to tell you about. Now, several years ago, somebody in my name wrote a hate letter of all things against the Filipino people. Now, as you know, Ramona, my dear departed wife was half Filipino, and so bad. It was awful then. It was absolutely awful then. And this thing now is years and years old. Of course, I did not write it. It was written, the FBI discovered, by somebody using a computer at UCSD, campus at San Diego, and at that time they didn't monitor who used the computer, so there was no way to trace. It went dead, and we never found out who sent the letter, but it certainly was not me. And then that letter, unfortunately, was picked up by a newspaper here, of all places, in Manila, and published. That tells you, even with all the warnings that it was fake and hoax, and that was all up, and they nevertheless did it. And now that letter is beginning to go around again on the internet. Actually, it never has stopped. But the fact that I'm now here in the Philippines is sort of an added little dimension to this, because here it goes around again. And I'm beginning to get a lot of death threats. Now, nobody lives forever, and I'm willing to take my chances, but this is getting a little silly. The Philippines is normally, particularly this part of the Philippines, is a relatively safe place to be. But with this kind of thing going around yet again on the internet, it's not all that safe for me. So I have posted the relevant information. There are actually many websites that have the information that it was false and bogus and baloney, and has been for years. But there's a certain, I don't know, there's a certain kind of repetitive power that keeps something like this going and going and going and going. And it's been going for years, and now that that I'm actually here in the Philippine Islands, it's kind of dangerous. So I've had the webmaster post again the fact that it's false, and if any of you can do anything to get it stopped before somebody decides to off me because of it, I certainly would appreciate it. So take a look at that. It's on the coasttocoastam.com website right now. And I would presume the fact that I'm now living in the Philippines probably prompted whoever sends this kind of horrible stuff around to start it going around again. Anyway, please take a moment and take a look at that. It's on the coasttocoastam.com website, and you can be damn sure I did not, would not ever write anything like that. Now, the world news. St. Louis. Well, this is not so good. Three young children found dead Saturday, just hours after a woman was charged with killing their pregnant mother and her fetus in a grisly attack in which her womb was cut open, said authorities. Two boys, 7 and 2, and their one-year-old sister found together. God, that's just horrible news. And then Venezuela. Well, of course, there's been a lot about Venezuela lately. The Venezuelan president sending oil and saying greasy things about our president. Venezuelans, a foreign minister said that he was, it seems, illegally detained, his words, for 90 minutes at a New York airport Saturday by U.S. authorities, who he accused of treating him abusively and attempting to frisk him. U.S. and U.N. officials called the incident regrettable, but said that Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro, said that Foreign Minister Nicolas Maduro had been identified for secondary screening, an added security check that can kick in for a variety of reasons, like your president saying bad things about our president, huh? Yeah, secondary security. I used to drive between the United States and Mexico when I worked for a Mexican radio station. Tijuana. And people would, you'd be waiting to go back into the U.S. from Mexico. And people would, on the Mexican side, have no respect whatsoever for the order of lines, or as my wife would say, to form a line. And they cut in. And it used to make me so angry that I would, I'd say, hey, you see that vehicle two behind me? He cut in line way ahead of everybody else. Well, those are the kind of people who can occasionally get to secondary inspection and they really tear a car apart, I'll tell you. So when I read this one, I laughed and laughed. An added security check, it says, that can kick in for a variety of reasons. High winds, heavy rain, tornadoes pounded parts of the Midwest and the South, leaving at least 8 people dead, stranding people in the cars, forcing others from their homes, leaving thousands without power. So here we go. The death toll in Kentucky on Saturday reached 7, including a father and his 1-year-old daughter in a truck that skidded into floodwaters. In Arkansas, a woman whose boat was struck by lightning died. Authorities were searching for 2 missing people. A lot of rumors going around about where bin Laden is, whether or not he's on the face of the globe anymore. A leaked French intelligence document raises the possibility that Osama bin Laden died of typhoid. But President Chirac said Saturday the report was in no way whatsoever confirmed, and officials from Kabul to Washington expressed skepticism about its accuracy. As for the rest of us, we can only hope. A Al-Qaeda-linked group posted a web video Saturday purporting to show the bodies of 2 American soldiers being dragged behind a truck, then set on fire in an apparent retaliation for the alleged rape-slaying of a young Iraqi woman by U.S. troops from the same unit, the Mujahideen Council, an umbrella organization of insurgent groups, including Al-Qaeda in Iraq, posted a previous video in June showing the soldiers' mutilated bodies and claiming it killed them. It's not clear whether Saturday's video was a continuation of that footage or why it might have been released right now. More than a third of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans seeking medical treatment from the Veterans Health Administration report symptoms of stress or other mental disorders. That would be a tenfold increase in the last 18 months, according to an agency study. Well, no surprise there. You go to war, and it's certainly is stressful. Speaking of war and disruption and all the rest of that, I'll have some, or as Paul would say, and I love to repeat, the rest of the news in a moment. Well, you can imagine my surprise when earlier in the week, perhaps you can imagine my surprise, if you look at a map and you note where the Philippines is, and you note where Thailand is, you will note they are our neighbor. So I was a little surprised. We all were, and quite shocked. And of course, it was big news here when we awoke to find out that the military, in a bloodless coup, had taken over Thailand, and there were tanks and armored vehicles in Bangkok and all the rest of it. Well, yes, indeed, there has been a coup in Thailand right next to me here. And somebody sent me this. The king, Art, no matter what happens in Thailand, will prevail as he has the total loyalty of all the citizens there. In the end, he'll solve this problem, as always. I travel to Thailand and most provinces, and I'm continually impressed with the 100% loyalty of the Thai people to their king. It's true. My wife is Thai, and my son is also. On any given Monday, you'll see about 75% of the people there wearing yellow shirts as a token of admiration to the king's assertion to the throne anniversary. So let the military and elected government beware, as the people will only follow the wishes of their king. Signed, Darren. Darren, I completely agree with you. And it looks as though it'll be all right, although you never know with a coup. All coups begin with the general in charge saying, of course, the freedoms that you've enjoyed and the Constitution will be returned to you shortly as soon as we straighten everything out, and you never really know until time passes. Nevertheless, you wake up and your neighboring country has had a coup and you pay attention. European, by the way, we're going to go to open line. So if you know the numbers and you've got something that would really rock to get on the air, you're welcome to begin dialing. European scientists voiced shock today as they viewed pictures which showed the Arctic ice cover, get this, had disappeared so much last month that a ship could sail unhindered from Europe's most northerly outpost all the way to the North Pole. Oh my God, the satellite images were acquired from August 23rd through the 25th by instruments aboard Evasat and EOS Aqua, two satellites operated by the European Space Agency, or ESA, perennial ice sheet, thick ice that is normally present year-round and is not affected by the Arctic summer, had virtually disappeared over an area bigger than the British Isles. Vast patches of ice-free sea stretched north from an island lying about midway between Norway and the North Pole and extended very deep into the Russian Arctic all the way to the North Pole, said the agency. The situation is unlike anything ever observed in any previous low record ice season, said Mark Drinkwater, interesting name, of ESA's Ocean Ice Unit. Drinkwater, huh? It is highly imaginable that a ship could have passed from northern Siberia through what is normally ice-packed to reach the North Pole without any difficulty whatsoever. Spitsbergen is one of the islands which are Norwegian. If this anomaly should persist, the Northeast Passage or Northern Sea Route between Europe and Asia will be open over longer intervals of time, and it is conceivable that we might see attempts at sailing around the world directly across the summer Arctic Ocean within the next 10 to 20 years, or if what they're saying is true, they might even try it, well, any time now, I suppose. If the federal government will not take a stand against global warming, individual states will have to do so alone. California, it turns out, has now filed a lawsuit against six leading car manufacturers, saying that the emissions from the cars they produce are changing the state's weather. Andrew Gumbel reports in The Independent that California Attorney General Bill Locklear is suing GM, Ford, Chrysler, Honda, Toyota, Nissan because of what they either knew or should have known the severe impact of their vehicles would have on the health of the planet. Vehicle emissions are the single most rapidly growing source of carbon emissions, contributing to global warming, yet the federal government and the automakers have refused to act. See, do I have time for this? I might have. I kind of like this. I don't know who sent this to me, but I just, for some reason, I like it. It's called The Way We Live Now. Ominous clouds. The day the Weather Channel went on the air nearly 20 years ago, it was balmy out. Clouds scudding in a high sky, no possibility of rain. Today, looking out my window, I see that's still the case. By the way, this was written by D.T. Max and published March 3rd, 2002. So he goes on, today looking out my window, I see it is still the case. The weather is still nice, at least there's a breeze. The Weather Channel anchor is right now warning me, though, the weather may change. A front is somewhere not very far away. They say there are five stories in Hollywood with the weather. There's always been only one. It will get cold, then it will get warm, warm, cold, warm, cold. The huge effort the Weather Channel makes to cover this repetitive story, 840 employees, 15,000 affiliated cable systems, a news budget of several million seems justified by its success. It has become part of the cable landscape with CNN and ESPN. That was not always the case. When the channel began in 82, people laughed. Even its own employees thought a national 24-hour day, 7-day week weather network was just, well, overkill. Wasn't the very point about weather that it was local and that we watched it only when we need it? But to everyone's surprise, the Weather Channel took. The subscription base ballooned from 2 million to 85 million homes. It turned out there were a lot of avid weather watchers out there. We provided heroin for the addicts, Ray Ban, the Weather Channel's chief meteorologist, says. What are we addicted to? What are we looking for? Not whether they need their raincoats on the other coast, I don't think. We watch the Weather Channel for the global read, the state of the planet, for reassurance that it'll all be okay. After a few years of big storms, bizarrely warm winters, and drought warnings, we no longer want nice weather. We just want normal weather. Which may explain why, though we've never needed it less, we've never been able to live, work, eat without going outside. We've never been big consumers of meteorological information. Today, though, there are some 4,000 websites covering the weather. And the Weather Channel's marketing people have noticed an intriguing phenomenon. People are watching their programs for longer than anyone ever expected. 8 minutes was the original projection. But one in four now watch for 20 minutes or more at a time. Well, people come for their own weather, but they stay for their neighbor's weather and finally for the weather around the world. No low in Asia is too obscure for them. No hiccup in the jet stream over Australia too far removed. The phenomena seems widespread in the weather industry. People are unsettled, said Ross Gelspan, founder of, I think it's heatsaligned.org, who has noticed a large increase in visitors to the site recently. It's the freakish weather that we're having. That's it, folks. The freakish weather. The Weather Channel's viewers skew to the affluent and the educated indoor types. We watch it nervously, scanning the weather for deviations from the norm. How many Category 4 hurricanes will there be this year? Can El Nino explain this hot winter, La Nina? Or is it our combustible engines, our coolants, our CFCs? The scientific jury may still be officially out on global warming. It's not, though. This presidential administration may be skeptical, but in January there were cherry blossoms in Brooklyn, cherry blossoms, mind you, and the thermostat in the Washington Metro turned on the air conditioning. These facts fill me with unease, and it's not just me. I spoke to Faith Gamill of the Switchin Tribe in northern Alaska, who said that members of the tribe, who for thousands of years have looked at the sky and been able to read the next day's weather, are now very confused. It's warm. Then it gets cold, then it gets, then the next day it snows, then it rains. No one can really seem to predict anymore. So it's appropriate that while local weather reports try to cheer you up and get you out the door, the Weather Channel doesn't. Its claustrophobic studio and low-tech effects, yellow, spiky sun, puffy white clouds, goofy jazz background music allow the depression over the Atlantic to merge with the one in your head. You feel invited to spend the day there brooding. That the Weather Channel was born just as the hole in the ozone layer first came to our attention. It grew to maturity, so to speak, under the same cloud we did. Never knowing the innocent time when 70-degree days in the winter were cause for rejoicing. Its meteorologists understand modern-day original sin. The world is no longer as we found it. Where once we needed the weather, now we feel the weather needs us. This is part of a larger inadvertent role we've assumed as custodians of our planet. We used to hunt. Then we just photographed. Now we restock. We run rivers, parks, species. We're responsible for reintroducing wolves to Yellowstone and reminding moose how to recognize their own scent. The hope that an obscure woodpecker in Louisiana might not be extinct has made it a media celebrity, because if it's dead, we killed it. When a baby gorilla is born in the Virunga Reserve in East Africa, researchers sometimes have a party to name it like Latter-day Adams. That's the same energy the Weather Channel draws on as we watch it. We silently hope that ours won't turn out to be the story of the Garden of Eden. We ate the apple. Then we cut down the tree. We couldn't resist. We wanted wood. Now we're worried that we're going to die from the sun. Compare that with the story in Genesis with the original weather report, bright morning, heavy rains, followed by clearing at dawn. After the Lord promised Noah, for as long as the earth existed, cold and heat, summer and winter shall not cease. Watching, we wonder, how do we go back to that? And I thought that was a very, very interesting article. I don't know why. I guess perhaps because I am also a Weather Channel devotee. Particularly when I was home in the U.S., I frequently would watch the Weather Channel, not just when the hurricanes were threatening some part of Louisiana or the southern U.S., but nearly all the time I found myself switching over to the Weather Channel, an interesting phenomena in this modern day, isn't it? From the Philippines, specifically Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Here indeed is Art Bell. Somebody had sent me a really funny little MP3 file about tequila. And I sent it off. I think it was Ben. Ben, you sent it to me, or Kay out there. Kay, I sent it to you and said, would this be appropriate to play on the air? It's a little iffy, but you know, And so, like an idiot, I just went to my email to check, and instead I wiped out all of my incoming emails. So if one of you two has it there and can resend it to me at that same address, I would appreciate it. I'd really like to play it on the air. I think the thing is a riot. So, you know, when you're in a hurry and you're getting on the air and you're thinking about playing something, so instead of doing the right thing, I just erased all of the incoming mail that I've had for about the last 2 months, which is very upsetting because I was saving several things that I meant. Anyway, one of you will send it to me again, and if I get it, I'll play it. In the meantime, let's do what we do. Oh, coming up at the top of the hour is Paul Mahler, Sky Car Paul Mahler. Now, Paul Mahler is building... I mean, haven't you all had flying dreams? This is, next to time travel, my favorite topic of all. Paul Mahler is building a sky car. What do I mean by sky car? Well, you'll learn in the next hour. But a private individual, just like you park your car in the parking spot or your garage or wherever you put your car, but this car flies. It flies. It hovers. It, you know. This is way cool stuff. So there's been progress, finally, on the Sky Car, and you will hear about it in the next hour. In the meantime, Wildcard Line, you are on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art. Santa, first caller, huh?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, great guest. The Mahler Sky Car, I've been following that for a long time, but that's not my question. It's just he's been on Popular Mechanics a lot. I can't wait to listen to him tonight. Anyway, what I did call for, I'm sure you're aware of it too, information from Saudi Arabia has leaked to the news press in France, and they're printing out information about that Bin Laden died of typhoid. What do you think?
Yes, I read that in the opening. They're not giving it much credibility, so I think Jacques Chirac said no, he doesn't believe it, and we can only hope.
Yeah. You know, what was running through my mind, I was thinking, you know what, almost everybody knows he's in Pakistan, so I was thinking Bin Laden's getting a little nervous, said, you know what, it's time to do a fake death and do a change of plastic surgery on old face.
Yeah.
And
that's certainly a thought, but I think they'd have to do a better job. I mean, how many leaks have we had that Bin Laden might have been killed here or killed there? Quite a few.
Yeah, but Nori, did you listen to the show? Nori had an interview about this so-called Bin Laden, new tapes coming out about Bin Laden. They actually, some terrorists came across the Mexican border with a nuclear weapon, and that's supposed to be the latest.
Yeah, jump on that a little bit. Yes, I have all of that here, but I chose not to air it because, frankly, I don't think it's anything more than an internet rumor at this point, And I don't think there's not enough substance to be scaring the hell out of people about that, in my opinion. So until there's more, until there's some substance to the story, I sort of chose not to air it. I've got it here, of course, and there are all kinds of things going around. I'm sure you've seen them on the internet, like all the Muslims have been leaving or will assume Christian names and all the rest of it. I'm sure many of you have seen the internet reports because something absolutely awful is going to happen. But at this point, I'm not going to air that as, you know, a reported article or even rumor for that matter. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning or whatever it is where you are.
Morning. I was just curious. Now, I get the impression from your response to the previous caller that perhaps you and George may differ as to what you choose to air.
No, I'm sure that's true. I mean, everybody. That isn't that what makes life interesting? You know, I'm for example, I'm one of those who thinks that all this President Bush ordered the planes to fly into our buildings stuff is baloney. George, I think, has another view of it, and we differ on many things. But you know, that's that's what it's all about. I mean, we all have different views.
My question relates to something that George mentioned. I have preferred to ask him this question, but it has to do with the mobile phones or cell phones.
Uh-huh.
And there was something that he read, and then he posted it on the website, the Coast website, next day. And I checked it out, and most of the things didn't work or didn't work well. And I was just curious.
First of all, I was the one who read that, not George.
Oh, you did. You read it. Okay.
Yeah. Now, it turns out they work for some people and not others. They work for me. The business about opening your car door remotely, that's baloney. That doesn't
mm-hmm.
work. The 15-digit code does work.
Yes.
And I also believe that the Nokia extra battery thing also works.
From one research I was able to do, it seemed like that was... I don't know if you want me to mention the website, but the one that deals with urban legends and the like.
Yeah.
Snopes.com. They seem to determine that one was, well, although it did produce the 15-digit code, it really didn't amount to anything because of the delay.
No, that's not true. That's a specific 15-digit code.
So if
you have that code and somebody steals your cell phone, you can call your provider and they can turn it off and lock it. And so the mm-hmm. jerk doesn't get to use your cell phone. No, it's true.
No, I'm not disagreeing with that. All I'm saying is that what the research bore out was that there is a delay that a thief would rely upon from the time you notice your phone is missing to the time that the phone service is canceled.
I suppose that could be the case, but I still love it. I mean, even if you never get your phone back, and they specified that in the report, if you give your provider that, they can lock the keyboard, lock the phone, turn it off, and all that. And so, you know, it can never be used again. And, of course, the stupid thief dare never go and try and get it working again because they would catch him. I've got a lot of very good stupid thief stories here. Stupid. Maybe hold them for tomorrow night. Really good stuff. On the next wild card line, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Is this Art? Yes.
It is. Yes, this is Art.
Yes. Yes. I have a book. It's called Chapter Degrees by Ronayne. It's about the Masons. It explains all of their ceremonies and everything. It's copyrighted 1901 and
yeah.
rewritten in 1963.
Yes.
And it says that it's a private book used only yes. within the Masons craft
yes.
in this country. And I was wondering if you would like to have it sent to you.
Hmm. Is there a lot of really cool secret stuff?
Yes. It explains all the ceremonies, secret alphabet, all that stuff. And
well, sure. Why not, sir? Fire away.
Okay, well, I wanted to send it to you, but they wouldn't tell me how to get it to you, and I will only send it to you. I don't trust anybody that might be a Mason. And they asked me if,
you know, I've been accused of being a Mason for a long time. Actually,
I know that.
Actually, I've heard that the Masons really are quite a benign, good organization that help an awful lot of people and not the secret... dastardly organization that some people make them out to be. The only way that I know that you can send me something is to fire it off to the network, and ultimately I suppose it might get to me. But I am, after all, now on the other side of the world. So I would say probably the network, but I don't know. Maybe the network will save stuff up and then ultimately send me a box of stuff. I don't know, but I really am on the other side of the world. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes. Can I, how are you tonight, Art?
Just fine.
I went to Las Vegas about 2 years ago to show you my new invention, but you just had a major tragedy, so I didn't stop in.
I see.
I, have
well, I was
a,
actually in Pahrump, Nevada, not in Las Vegas, but close.
Yes, sir. It was a crump. That's where I was. That's where I went.
I see.
But anyway, I told you about 6 years ago that me and my friend 40 years ago was driving around Los Angeles getting 456 miles to the gallon of gas.
Using what?
Using regular gasoline. We burned.
Weren't you curious why you were getting so much per gallon?
Well, no, sir. Now we can get even more because it expands 269 times.
This is your invention. What is your invention?
It puts out zero pollution.
Mm-hmm. No. What is your invention?
It is... what it does is it vaporizes the gas.
I've heard of this, and I guess I recall getting an email from you or something, but instead of feeding in the normal way, it vaporizes the gasoline. Yeah, I remember that.
It vaporizes it and goes down the Ventura, you know, the intake of the carburetor.
Mm-hmm.
And we can get up to over 2,000 miles a gallon in it.
Mm-hmm.
But remember,
aren't you
like
afraid that one of the major automakers will have you offed?
Well, they offed my partner that originally was working with me.
See what I mean?
Over 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I've kept this off the market, afraid to bring it out, but I've had two heart attacks and died twice. Well, what are they going to do to me?
I know the feeling. Yeah, I know the feeling. I'm going through that right now with this godforsaken email, this Filipino hoax email that you can read about. If I guess there are so many people going there that we've broken the link, but again, you only live once. Well, look, what I would suggest to you is to email me the specifics again. I'll go over it, but I do recall the original email that you sent me and the original information. I appreciate your not having tried to stop by during that time. I'll tell you what, we're going to take a quick break and we'll get right back to open lines. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, all right, back to open lines we go. That always happens to me. I get so involved in what I'm doing, I'm liable to blow a break. Wild card line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. Fred in Michigan, and great to be talking with you again. In fact, your Moody Blues bumper music I really do love.
My favorite.
Yeah, and have you ever heard Seventh Sojourn?
Oh, sure.
Seventh Sojourn.
Of course.
Okay, well, there's a couple cuts on there you might want to consider for some bumper music.
I'll look into it.
Pardon?
I say I'll look into it.
Great. The weather, Art, is a recurring concern of mine. And, you know, James McCanney offers some, I'd say, some scholarly insight into understanding these strange storms that have occurred throughout the 90s, and I hope you can interview him sometime.
Well, I have already done so. I've interviewed him a number of times. I think that there's no great mystery to what's going on in the world right now, whether you want to look at the north and south part of our world and the calving of the The icebergs in the south, the fact that we can now navigate to the North Pole, where before it was solidly frozen, the fact that the temperatures in Alaska are going up so quickly that polar bears are drowning, and the ice is virtually soon to be no more. I mean, all of these things are not a big mystery. All of these things are a clear indicator of why our weather is becoming a little rougher and will ultimately become a lot rougher. It's getting warmer. Heat fuels storms. It's really that simple. Heat fuels storms. So it's going to get rough out there. On the international line from Stockholm, Sweden, of all places, Sean, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Sean. As you said, I was lucky enough to get a hold of you via Skype, which is a computer telephonic service.
I know Skype well, and I use it here. So how you doing in Sweden?
Oh, I'm doing great. The weather's actually warm. It's really funny. It's supposed to be cool, but everyone says, we don't know why it's so warm here. But it's been interesting. The reason I called, Art, was I wanted to talk to you specifically about this company out of Ireland called Stjorn. They put an ad in The Economist last month about inviting scientists to look at their free energy model using magnets. And I wanted to know if you had heard anything, either by email or on the radio, about them.
I indeed have heard about them. So, yes, I'm aware.
Yeah, have you heard any feedback of anyone taking up on this challenge, going there to investigate this probability that there might be
I know that there are thousands of inquiries apparently that have been made, and so I suppose testing is going to take some time, but I'm hopeful that this might be the real McCoy just because of the way they've approached it. You know, they've said, come on, you're invited, scientists, let's test this and see if it's real. So I hope to heck it is.
Yeah, well, I concur. And those Irish folks, they're pretty straight as far as, you know, presenting data. Usually none of that stuff's, you know, misrepresented. So I'm glad they took their time to do their own investigations before presenting this to the public.
Well, I am as well. You say that the weather in Sweden, in Stockholm, is fairly warm right now.
Warm, yeah. I actually had a friend who works up here, and he was heading to Barcelona for a conference, and he said, you know what? He goes, I'm going to go from warm to warmer, and he goes, this time of year, he doesn't expect things to get up above, you know, the mid-60s to 70, and yesterday it was in the low 80s. So it's
oh my gosh,
different from what's considered normal.
That is incredible. All right. Well, listen, thank you very, very much for the call. Yes, I'm very much aware of the story, and we're all kind of sitting back, I guess, holding our breath a little bit and hoping all of that is absolutely real. God knows the world needs it. For Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Hello, Art.
Hello.
Yes, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I just have a question about the tape from, was it Alaska, the drillers? That supposedly heard the noises
That was from now Siberia. And,
Siberia,
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, that originally ran on Reuters. It was a Reuters news story, and then I obtained the audio. It's drilling. You know, they drilled a hole. They lowered a microphone, deepest hole in the world. Scientists got this horrid noise back, like millions of people screaming in hell.
Yeah.
And the story is they filled the hole and took off.
Okay. How far did they actually drill to get these sounds?
You know, I'm trying to remember. It was the deepest hole at that time in the world, and I don't recall how deep it was, but apparently deep enough.
Yeah. I tell you, if that was real, that would be very, very spooky. Yeah. Was the tape ever analyzed, like by professionals, to see if it's actually legit? Or...
I think all kinds of people looked at that tape, and... you know, it's said to be not real, but it was a major news agency that they reported all of this, and so I'm left in the dark. You know, some people think it's a hoax, others not.
You're probably playing on the on Halloween when you have your show, right?
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay, it was a pleasure to speak to you.
Okay, buddy, take care. Let's go east of the Rockies and say you're on the air.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
Hi, this is Dan from Pennsylvania.
Hey, Dan.
Very good to talk to you tonight. I've been a long-time listener and a first-time caller. I have a prediction/theory about, it involves 2012.
Okay.
Well, the theory part is, this will work for a lot of the, evolutionist people out there, but, if you look at how evolution says we went from ape-like creatures to where we are now as humans, I believe you can possibly extend that one step further and take it all the way up to an alien-type race.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time here, so any very quickly.
I'm just thinking that maybe when 2012 comes around, at the end of the Mayan calendar, it's not really going to be the end times as we see it. It may just be the ushering in of a new type of life on Earth. Possibly aliens may actually show themselves more distinctly around that time.
Well, I hope, my friend, that you are correct. There are others, of course, who feel the... Well, it's kind of a choice. Did the Mayans get sick of writing calendars, or is that the end of all time? From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. You know, it's worthy of note that Hurricane Helena... which, you know, hurricanes normally start off the coast of Africa, travel their way across the Atlantic and, you know, hit Florida or the Gulf Coast or just travel north a little and poop out. But Helena looks as though it's going to hit Ireland as at least tropical depression. And I'm sure that's a surprise. I don't know how many times that's ever happened in history, but... It's on its way, so across it came, and then back across it went, still at least a tropical depression. That's absolutely incredible. Coming up in a moment, Dr. Paul Mahler. He is the founder and chairman of the board, has served as the president of Mahler International since its original formation in 1983. Mahler International was formed to develop a powered lift aircraft called Skycar, and other related technologies. Dr. Mahler holds a master's in engineering and a PhD from McGill University. He was a professor of mechanical and aeronautical engineering at the University of California, Davis from 1963 through 75. In 1972, he founded Supertrap Industries, which became the most recognized international name in high-performance engine silencing systems. Dr. Mahler has received 43 patents, including the first U.S. patent on a fundamentally new form of power lift aircraft, and yet another on the revolutionary rotopower engine. In 1997, he created Freedom Motors to manufacture and distribute this engine. Most of all, though, my God, he's building this sky car. This is a car for all of us, you know, the little people who will... be able to walk out into their driveway, hop in, and fly. Dr. Mahler in a moment. It absolutely has been my dream, and I think I've related this to Paul any number of times. Paul Mahler, welcome back to Coast AM.
Yes, good evening, Art. A pleasure to be back with you.
Oh, it's so good to have you. It is my dream car. I've had a lot of nice cars, but yours is absolutely my dream car. So I guess we have to bear in mind that it's been a long time, Paul, since you've been on, so let's roll over the basics. What is the history of your company in the Skycar?
Well, back in the 60s, I got very interested in trying to, I guess, create something that did pretty much what a hummingbird does, but something that you could get in and end up like a mechanical hummingbird, I suppose. I didn't really realize the true complexity of it, all of the theoretical, in particular how much it was going to cost and how much technology was involved. But I guess we wouldn't get in things like this if we understood how big a problem they really are when we start out. That was the goal, to create something that you could really maneuver around front, back, up, down, in a comfortable and easy manner, and most importantly, in a safe manner. So the number one goal was, how do you make this vehicle so safe that there's nothing that can go wrong, because you don't park at the side of the road when something goes wrong and you're in the air.
Gee, I wonder, Paul, does that really have to be your goal, that nothing can go wrong? I mean, we have in excess of 50,000 people now that die on our highways every year. So I think the Skycar could still gain wide acceptance even if occasionally something went wrong. I mean, that's going to happen with any machine, anywhere, anytime, almost no matter what, right?
Certainly, and one of the advantages is that you can really computerize the vehicle, and you can computerize the so-called highway in the sky, the acronym is HIPS, that's really coming into place right now. And if you do that, you take the pilot out of the loop, and as you know, and most people probably realize, most of the accidents today are due to error on the part of the driver. So mm-hmm. if we can get that out of the loop, which we believe we can, we've already improved things. But clearly you have to make the vehicle very safe as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you have, to some degree or another, and perhaps more so since we last spoke, tested the unmanned version, I know, of the Sky Car. How well did it fly? What kind of test was it? And tell me about it.
Well, we, of course, the Sky Car is the end of a series. We had an earlier aircraft that was much more like the Jetsons. It's easy to describe that way because I think most people have an image of the Jetsons car. And we flew that vehicle very successfully many, many times. But what it wasn't capable of doing was flying fast. And we really knew that if you're going to make a change in transportation, you're going to have to make a change in the speed at which we get around as well. And so we moved from that Jetson-like vehicle to what we have today, which is often described as a Batmobile-type vehicle. Which,
a Batmobile, huh?
Well, that wouldn't be my term, but when I'm asked to describe it, I really don't have a terminology that allows you to describe it, except that it looks perhaps for some people, from some people's point of view, a bit like a Batmobile.
Hmm. Okay. We've got some links up on Coast to Coast AM right now, and I would presume that I can get to see the latest with a link. Let me take a look here.
Well, it's probably not the latest, but it would probably serve your purpose. That, you know, one of the vehicles we flew is available on the internet.
Okay, would that be the M400?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, that is one beautiful car, and I would urge you all to go up to coasttocoastam.com and take a look. I mean, this thing is absolutely beautiful. All right. What do we know now about this car? What is it capable of doing?
Well, much of the numbers that I give you are numbers that come out of computer analysis or wind tunnel testing, because this is not the safest career in the world when you're in the early mode of testing, because there are a number of things that could go wrong, and it's not like an airplane that can glide somewhere or that you can parachute out of, because if you're hovering, that isn't an option. So we've had to be very, very careful in our initial efforts. But we've flown it a number of times. We've actually run it with a failed engine and landed it safely.
Wow!
And that, of course, is critical. That's
now, how does that work? You say you've flown it with a failed engine. What happens when the engine fails?
Well, we have a very fast set of computers on board, and we have many computers that talk to each other. And if one computer is not telling the same story as the other three, it's kicked out of the system. That's called a voting system, and it's the same system that's used on the F-16 or, in fact, on the space shuttle or the shot to the moon. It's a very, very safe and reliable way to work. And so that's the most important thing of all, that you have the computers telling the engines and everything else what to do. And they really not only sense the attitude and the direction and the acceleration of the vehicle, but you have, of course, algorithms that then take that information and convert it into making the vehicle stable. Most important thing, though, is you can fail something, as we said, like the engine, and the vehicle will correct itself so quickly that you don't even know you failed an engine. We've landed the engine in one case in an earlier flight where we didn't even know the engine had stopped running.
How many engines are in the Sky Car?
We have 8 engines, but that sounds scary when you think about it, but it's really like taking an 8-cylinder engine and breaking it up into 8 single 1-cylinder engines and then integrating them with a computer so that if one engine or one piston goes out in a V8 engine, the engine continues to function. That's
okay.
The concept.
Okay, so if are these actually separate engines, or
absolutely
am I to think
separate? So that they can fail, and the computers will say, we need more thrust on that side of the vehicle or in that particular lift pod. to take up for the fact that we're seeing the thrust reducing, and it'll do it very quickly. It does it in something like 25 milliseconds, which is, you know, an extremely short period of time.
How many people can sit in a sky car?
Well, the M400 is a four-passenger vehicle. We've done wind tunnel testing on a six-passenger, but that's about as big as you can go, for the reasons that the laws of physics don't work on your behalf if you get bigger than that.
Okay.
So that's you change the different configuration, maybe like the B-22 Osprey, the tilt rotor aircraft, if you want to go with more people than that. But
okay.
To six people it can be designed.
Okay, so up to six, but the one you've got will comfortably seat four people. And does it lift vertically
and
take off?
And that's the critical thing. That's the hummingbird part of it all. It can take off vertically. It can hover. And if you leave it alone, it'll just sit there and take care of itself. It'll sit there and hover and ask for a demand, basically. If you don't touch the controls, it'll sit and wait until you give it a command, which, of course, makes it very easy to fly. I mean, I'm the test pilot, and I'm not in any way a particularly skilled pilot. I can just comfortably sit there and decide slowly what I want to do.
All right. What about range? Or I have so many questions. What about speed? Forward speed? How fast?
Well, the vehicle's fast because, of course, it has a large amount of power. To take off vertically, you need at least 750 horsepower for this vehicle, which weighs a little over one ton.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have that kind of power, of course, when you're going forward, that's more power than you need. In actual fact, we use a lot less than that in forward flight. But we still can achieve a speed close to 400 miles an hour, again, based on wind tunnel testing and computer analysis. But we wouldn't fly at that. It's a little like going down the highway at 100 miles an hour. You're going to burn a lot of fuel. We would say 300 miles an hour at 25,000 feet or 200 miles an hour at sea level are two very good speeds to operate at.
And the working ceiling?
30,000 feet, but then you start getting close to the airline network, so we generally suggest that 25,000 is the maximum height to go at.
I want one. I really
Well, I wish I had one every day myself, because like everybody else, I'd like to go off to that mountaintop in the distance and land and see what it's like up there.
Okay. Well, that quickly, of course, it brings in a million different questions. For example, even now, with airliners and small aircraft, our skies are, you know, fairly crowded. If we had a situation where people were off the ground in their automobiles and they were able to go to the sky, wouldn't the skies get dangerously crowded?
You know, that's an extremely good question. And I'll just start by saying that if every car that's on the road today in America were in the air at the same time in this hits this highway in the sky, they would still be miles apart. We have this enormous amount of basically unused space, and even though we think it's scary, it's primarily scary because it's not very controlled. It's kind of random. The pilots are still asked to keep looking out the window to see if somebody's coming towards them from some different direction. That's not the world in which you want to operate this vehicle in. This vehicle is going to be able to sense through GPS and many other sources exactly who's around you, and it's going to be directing itself. You're not going to be directing it. This highway in the sky that I refer to is quite advanced. It's a lot more advanced than most people realize. It's starting to be used, and it's going to be used extensively in the coming years.
Well, it's interesting, and I understand that you have to do it in the manner that you're describing, where the driver, the pilot of this thing, really doesn't have much to do except perhaps push a button or contribute to the guidance computer or whatever, and then it sort of all happens automatically. Is that correct?
That's one form. Of course, that's the form that you'd probably say would be appropriate for mass transportation, getting us all around in a commute network. But if you really want to use this as a pilot, where you're going to have fun and roll it around and do a lot of things you do in a light plane today,
yes,
you just have to stay off that highway in the sky, which is well-defined, and there's all kinds of ways to protect you from getting into that. And you could go out and fly this, but you'd then have to have some level of skill. You'd have to have what's called a powered lift pilot's license, which you can get today for it in that case. But otherwise, you probably only have to register your name. So, I mean, a 90-year-old woman could get around in this vehicle in the highway in the sky, but if you are an enthusiast, flying enthusiast, you could also do all kinds of things with it.
So each one of them would be equipped to do both, is that correct?
Each one would be equipped to do both, but when you go onto the highway in the sky, you're locked out of the system. There's no way you can touch the controls or change them or anything as long as you're in that network. And that when you're in that network, you're under computer control or multiple computer controls.
All right, Paul, where are you now with range? In other words, on a tank of whatever this burns, and that's, I guess, the first question. What does it burn, and how far can you go?
That's a good start. If you're burning gasoline, it has the capability of going 750 miles on a tank of gas, which is about 45 gallons. But if you're burning ethanol, which is what we use, because we really think the future of this kind of transportation system really should be centered around something like ethanol. It's safe. It doesn't have near the fire hazard. It doesn't generate any toxicity, really. We just recently, and this is probably the most exciting thing that's happened since you and I last talked, we just recently showed that our engine it produces emissions that are way below the super ultra-low emissions for California. Which means, quite frankly, that when our engine is operating, it actually is cleaning the air in most major cities.
Well, that's amazing. Is your engine the some version or something of the Wankel? Is it like the Wankel rotary engine?
Yes, it is. In fact, I owe my greatest debt to Felix Wankel of anybody in the world, because quite frankly, without his invention of the Wankel engine, I would not have a sky car. I wouldn't have an aerobot. I wouldn't have a hybrid car that we created with the engine. There's many things that we've shown that become practical and real just because of the Wankel engine, which we've made a number of changes in, but still was basically invented by Dr. Felix Wankel.
Okay. A lot of people would like to know about this engine. A lot of people don't know about it. It's a rotary engine. I owned a car with a rotary engine in it, and it was fantastic. I love that car, and perhaps you can explain to the audience what the Wankel engine is.
That's a lot more difficult than explaining the sky car, I can tell you, because it's really a triangular-shaped rotor inside of a peanut-shaped chamber. But to describe how it functions, I can say, superficially certain things about it that are really important. It's a four-stroke engine, which is very important because four-stroke engines have very little pollution normally compared to two strokes. Mm-hmm. But it's much lighter. It's about as powerful as a turbine engine, at least in the form that we've developed it, for its weight. We can generate as much as 2 horsepower per pound. And, of course, that's very critical because we need a lot of horsepower, but we don't want that horsepower to be used up in weight, and so we don't have payload. And that, if I had not developed this engine as a result of Wankel's invention, I simply would not have a sky car. It's critical, absolutely essential.
Okay. I think I ran this by you one time before, but I noticed when I had my rotary engine vehicle, I'm a person who always likes to know where I'm going. So I would buy these very nice little things that I would put on the dashboard that would tell me whether I'm going north, south, east, west, whatever direction I'm going. A compass,
right.
Floating, they have these floating compasses that you can put in vehicles. And I did that when I had my Wankel engine vehicle. And inevitably, and every time, and this is something nobody ever talks about, but it would magnetize it so that I was always pointed, it was always pointed toward the engine, ultimately, after 3 or 4 weeks of operating. And I don't know how many people know this, but there had to have been a gigantic, or at least a fairly large, magnetic field that was being generated by the rotary engine that ended up permanently magnetizing.
That's very interesting. I've not experienced it, but it is a rotary motion, and certainly as a rotary motion, it would be more likely to generate something like that than one that just went back and forth, of course, which would tend to, might create a magnetic field, but also would get rid of it. So but what you're telling me is new to me. I was not aware that happened.
Okay, well, just for fun, you might test that, because it wasn't just with one compass. I recall buying three or four and then finally figuring out, my God, it was my engine that was doing this. And so after three or four of them, I was pretty damn sure that was it. So you might take a look at the engine and see if your engine's doing that. Perhaps there's some other shielding or something you have that is preventing that. But that is something that a rotary engine did, and it was totally fascinating. I can certainly see its application in what you're doing with the Sky Car. Now, we're coming up on a break, but I really want to know, Paul, how the testing has been going. And, you know, this has been going on quite a while now, and people are dying to know what kind of progress you've made in the testing that you've done thus far. And for that matter, how close we're getting to being able to actually get these on the market. I've heard that when we do get them on the market, they're being mass produced. It might be $50,000 or $60,000 per copy. Can you imagine that, folks? A car that flies for $50,000 or $60,000. I'm Art Bell. Absolutely, it cannot be just my dream. I'm sure many of you out there have exactly the same dream. Imagine being able to walk out your front door, walk up to this sleek, beautiful Sky Car, and you can see a picture of it on coasttocoastam.com website, and getting in, pushing a couple of buttons, setting the navigation, whatever, and flying. I mean, isn't it everybody's dream, flying? We see it in almost every futuristic movie, from Star Wars to, well, you name it, it doesn't matter. The personal flying vehicle. Paul Mahler is working on exactly that. It's called the Sky Car. More in a moment. Once again, Paul Mahler. So, Paul, catch us up on testing. Now, you've had a big breakthrough, I guess, in fuel, and that certainly sounds good. But if I recall correctly, the last time you and I interviewed, you had only sort of had a hovering test. Is that correct?
Right. We've expanded the hovering somewhat since then, but quite frankly, we knew that for this Sky Car to be something that everybody could own, we had to come up with not only a better engine, but we had to come up with the facility that could produce this engine inexpensively. And so much of what we've been doing since you and I last talked is working on that heart and muscle and guts of the Sky Car, the engine. And we now are in a position where we're going to be setting up a plant, a major plant, a $500 million plant in Eastern Europe to produce the engine in extremely high volumes. Now, not just for the Sky Car, of course, much like our Supertrap muffler, if we can produce a product that has a lot of other uses, and clearly this does, then we have an inexpensive engine for the Sky Car, and that allows us to get the price of the Sky Car down, because the controlling factor in the Sky Car's price is going to be the engine. If we can get that price down, we get the Sky Car price down.
Down to eventually $50,000 to $60,000 per?
Right, and we have a very big task to do that in this case, because we have 750 horsepower. And so it's a large amount of power, but we still have to get that cost to be about 20 to 25% the cost of the vehicle, which means if we're going to produce a $50,000 vehicle, we have to produce an engine for around $10,000 that has a reliable 750 horsepower.
But even so, Paul, if the price were three or four times what you're talking about, you know, for eventually in mass production or something, I assure you there's plenty of people with plenty of money who would plunk it down and buy one right now if you had them, even at an inflated price. And I would assume that before you get to the mass production you're talking about, there will be models that people can buy at a somewhat inflated price. I guarantee people would pay it.
That's true, and of course, we've identified a huge military market as well. We've already supplied a number of our vehicles to the military for unmanned applications, prototypes, really, for their test purposes. And we are proposing to supply unmanned versions of the Sky Car to the military, as well as, a little later, manned versions. But we think this is a good way to start out testing it in that environment. simply because they have, you know, very skilled pilots and a lot of test facilities that would be very useful for us.
Okay, stay good and close to the phone for me. Your voice is kind of fading out on me a little.
Okay,
here.
I'll try to get as close as I can.
That's good. Okay, so you say you've sold unmanned versions to the military. What, if it's not classified, what are they capable of doing?
Well, I'll talk about one that we delivered to the Air Force. It was designed for airfield damage assessment in case of a nuclear attack. They wanted something that could go out there without a pilot on board, that could look over the damage and make an assessment, and clearly that had to be unmanned in that environment. And we delivered two of those. They went to Wright-Patterson, but I think that, like a lot of things at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, they were kept in a secret mode, and they were not a lot was told about them.
I'll be damned. I had not heard this before. Okay, so these were capable of vertical takeoff and landing, and what sort of forward flight
speed?
Well,
they didn't need to go very fast because they were designed to go out there, you know, within a couple miles of the site, go out and take a look, hover for a while, get some pictures, get some radiation numbers, and then go on back. So they were like a single duct with a fan horizontal, which could hover for, you know, a reasonable length of time and then return home.
Okay. So when do you anticipate you might begin testing forward flight with the Skycar?
Well, that's really kind of an economic issue because the next stage and where we're going is very expensive and too expensive, quite frankly, for a company like ours, even though we're a public company and we're actually going to be profitable as a public company in the coming quarter, that's not the kind of money, we would not be generating the kind of money that's needed to bring this to the next level. And so really what we're doing is we're talking to a number of major aerospace companies with the view that they would become a partner with us. Well, not necessarily aerospace. It can be companies like General Electric, too. There's no real reason it has to be aerospace. It's not the auto industry for obvious reasons. Right now, it's barely thriving, so at least in America. So we were looking at, you know, thriving, successful companies that have a lot of vision and fairly deep pockets to allow us to move to the next level.
You know, you'd probably be somebody to comment on the current condition of the big three car companies in the U.S. What is going wrong in America with our automobile production, and where do we stand right now? They are in trouble, aren't they?
They're in real serious trouble, and you know, there's many things that might account for it, and I won't get into a lot of the issues of long-term labor issues that might be part of it, but I will comment on the fact that, you know, I've talked to these people and I've heard other people comment. They made things in the past, statements in the past like, we're never going to build a hybrid car because we don't think hybrid cars have a future. With that lack of vision, you can understand why they might have serious problems. We built a hybrid car back in the mid-1990s using one of our rotor power engines. And this was a car, it was based around a Honda Civic, and it went 0 to 60 in under 6 seconds and was projected to get 70 miles to the gallon of gas. I think that hybrid cars certainly were recognized by Honda and Toyota a long time ago as having a future. Why Detroit couldn't see this as an option, now they have to go and lease these rights or acquire these rights through license from the Japanese companies. This is unnecessary, but this is one example.
All right, well, I'm not sure if it's Brazil, but I think it might be Brazil, which has almost transitioned, I'm told, entirely to hybrid cars, or very nearly entirely to hybrid cars, and it's all working very well indeed. Are you aware of that?
Well, they're hybrid. There's many hybrids, but really what you're probably referring to is dual fuel
that's right.
cars, and that's Brazil. And that, of course, what is most interesting there is they're able in the very near future to run the whole country on ethanol. There won't be any gasoline going into their cars.
That's right.
That's the most exciting thing, and I think that that's something we could do in time here. It would take us a long time because we burn a lot of fuel in America. But still, ethanol is a wonderful option. It certainly is the option for the Skycar because it does so many other advantages besides being very clean and not dependent upon the Far East or the Middle East.
Well, if a whole country like Brazil can do something like this, I refuse to believe that a country with our abilities, America, cannot.
Well, yeah, it takes a national commitment, which apparently we're not willing to provide at this point in time. There has to be some incentives initially, and of course we have provided incentives to the ethanol industry here. By the way, our company is sponsored by the ethanol industry. They think that the ethanol is a big future in this type of transportation, and we're working with them to make that a case.
Are you ever tempted? I mean, does the day come when you just say, you know, I really want to give it a shot and go out there to your test vehicle and get in and at least go up and hover for a while?
Well, you know, that's probably the biggest thrill in my life is when I get the option to fly this. But, you know, I have a large number of stockholders, and I only really have one vehicle. And until we get sufficient funding that we can build more vehicles, and perhaps I can develop the potential to have more lives, because clearly this is a risky adventure, I think that that's an option that I can't pursue as much as I would like to, because the few times I've had a chance to really push the limits. And, of course, I pushed the limits much harder in the Jetson-type vehicle. I flew that over quite a distance at greater heights because we had flown it long enough. We were a little more comfortable with the technology.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a truly magic carpet flight, and I'd love to be back there every day. It's one of the things that drives me forward is the incredible thrill of a vehicle that flies like that.
Of course. Paul, around the world, you know, it's my dream, has been my dream for a long time, and it's got to be a fairly common dream. There have got to be others around the world working on this concept. What do you know?
Well, there are, but, you know, the price of entry is so high. Our company, which is a really modest company, has spent, in today's dollars, over $200 million, an astronomical amount of money, considering that we really would be in many ways classified, for instance, by venture capitalists, a startup company, because we still have not produced a product for the market, at least in this particular generation of products. And so the issue is that when you're dealing with that kind of technology and that kind of cost, the only people that can really do that normally, and I guess that means I'm abnormal, is the military. And privately, certainly the big companies, if they can't even consider that hybrid cars are an option in America, you can imagine how they view something that's going to fly.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen from any car company, certainly, even though Toyota has a very strong interest in the Sky Car, and Honda's been with to visit me, and BMW. I can say the GM has not, nor has Chrysler. But it's a moving possibility that we think has a big future in that direction.
$200 million on the one hand is a lot of money, and on the other isn't. I mean, in a way it is, certainly. But and in fact, how have you done that? $200 million for an individual or even a small company is one hell of a lot of money.
Well, that's one of the reasons it's taken me so long, because, of course, to do that, I've had to do a lot of other things. I've had to go out there and become a real estate. I'm in real estate. I've made many millions of dollars in real estate, which always ended up back in this technology, much to the concern of my wife. And I've, of course, had the Supertrap muffler, where we did about $200 million in sales over a number of years. I built a number of unmanned aircraft for the military, as I said earlier, but these tend to, you know, reduce the amount of effort I can put in one direction at any one time. So it is not something that I can pursue as aggressively as I would like, but clearly at this point in time, I recognize that I have to have a partner, and that's exactly, I'm not at liberty to tell the kinds of names we're talking to, but I can tell you one of the people that we have as a potential strategic partner is one of the largest corporations in America.
Uh-huh. Justin in Phoenix, Arizona asks, if the Skyway system is eventually so advanced, would it be so advanced that a blind person, for example, might be able to operate a Sky Car?
Absolutely. Absolutely, because you can do voice communication. because really all you're doing when you get on board this vehicle is telling it where you want it to take you. And, of course, that may sound a little extreme, but you forget today we send missiles, theoretically, down chimneys of places we don't like.
That's right.
So if we can do that kind of thing, we can certainly take you and put you wherever you want to go very safely.
Well, why not? So even a blind person could operate it. It would answer a lot of our pollution problems. You say that in the current situation with the current fuel you're using, it actually, you used the term cleans the air. Explain that.
Well, the emission levels required under the super ultra low emissions are very, very low. They're considered the lowest that any vehicle can achieve. In actual fact, our emissions of two of the three pollutants is only 2% of those emissions that are considered lower than anything they've ever seen in a vehicle. So we have emissions so low that they are less than the ambient conditions in cities like Los Angeles or Sacramento. Certainly, that's not true of all cities, but those two examples are two cities where when our engine is operating, it will actually reduce the emissions in the air that exist already.
That's amazing. If a person owned a sky car the way you envision it, would you have to drive it to an airport somewhere and take off from the airport, or could you go out to your driveway / personal little airport, lift off vertically and go?
Well, I would say for the next 15 years, you would drive it. It is legal on the street. It's not. I would not say you would drive it on the highway. It's not designed to go 65 miles an hour on the highway. But right. Certainly you could drive it at 30 miles an hour on the street to a vertiport, as they might be called, a few blocks, perhaps even a mile or two from your home, and take off from there.
Okay, why?
Pardon me?
Why? In other words, if it'll take off vertically, what is the issue? Is the issue that there's a lot of thrust?
The issue there for the time being is control. Amongst other things, that whatever system, highway in the sky system, it's going to have to, it can't be that advanced within this period of time, because it takes a finite time to have a system first that can even take you off from a vertiport reliably, controlling you in relationship to everybody else.
I see.
But if you're coming from your home, then you've got a really major quantum step, more difficult problem. But there's another factor. I can get rid of noise, and I can get rid of a lot of things, but I cannot get rid of the wind. And this thing would be a great vehicle to clean your driveway and your neighbor's driveway and perhaps a half a block from you. So really where you want to take off from is you want to take off from a flat roof house, and not everybody has a flat roof house. Of course, you can take off from your backyard if you have a decent-sized yard and some barrier protection, but it does generate significant wind, and so that would be a factor as well. I think in the future you're going to see a lot of houses. If the sky car becomes what I believe it will, you're going to see a lot of flat roof houses.
Well, how does the wind it generates compare to, say, a traditional helicopter?
Well, interesting enough, it's actually less disruptive in many ways because it is not as big a volume. But immediately underneath it, it's certainly a higher speed. So if you're talking about a landing on a driveway, you're not going to do much problem there. But if you're going out over an area over top of somebody's head, for example, they're going to get a real blast of air compared to a helicopter. But the overall impact is actually less than a helicopter in many ways, because a helicopter moves so much more air.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, you're talking about this guide network. How would that work? How would the guide network work? Function. Let's assume that you take off from a predestined little airport a couple miles from your home or whatever. Then what? How does it work?
Well, one of the major elements is GPS. GPS is a global positioning satellite that you see in some cars today, or it's utilized in cars and airplanes to locate where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of people realize that there are supplemental systems going into place that'll take that GPS signal, which now allows to position you within 20 to 30 feet accurately, that'll position you within millimeters accurately. Mm-hmm. There are supplemental systems like WAAS, which stands for Wide Area Augmentation System, and LAS for Local Area Augmentation System. And then there's TCAS and ABS-B. There's a bunch of systems out there that are going in place or are in place that allow you to know exactly where everybody is precisely at all times.
Mm-hmm.
That's one part of the formula. The second one is this virtual highway in the sky where everybody flies at exactly the same speed, at exactly the same altitude when they're going at a specific in a specific direction. So you have these series of vectors, so to speak, but you don't really see them. You just are guided on them in this highway in the sky system.
All right. All right. Paul Mahler is my guest. He is the Sky Car guy. If you want to see a picture of the Sky Car, you can go to coasttocoastam.com. And, boy, it's pretty sleek and pretty good looking. Imagine hopping in that. Up you go and away you go. Up, up, and away, I think the term is. From Philippines, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Seems like it ought to be reality already, doesn't it? Paul Mahler is my guest. He's a Sky Car guy, and actually, we've had a series of interviews with Paul that spanned quite a number of years now, and still the car has done nothing really much more than hover. But the promise, of course, is that it would be able to go, oh, I don't know, 600 or 700 miles on a tank of, I presume now, ethanol. It would fly at perhaps 25,000 feet. It would take you from here to there at about 300 miles an hour. It would be an amazing, amazing device. Can you imagine air in America, the air above America, the airspace just filled with these things going back and forth on these virtual highways that Paul is describing? He certainly can imagine it. He's sunk an awful lot of money into this. In fact, we'll talk about the money angle of all this in a moment. Once again, here is Paul Mahler. Paul, if you had an infusion of money, of serious capital, how much money do you think it would take to take what you have got right now and make it completely workable?
Well, workable to the extent that you'd be able to buy an aircraft for, say, $250,000. There's a big difference between getting to 50,000 versus a $250,000.
I understand.
A quarter of a million dollar vehicle, we could probably do for about $100 million investment, just simply because you tool up for that level of production that would go with that, which might be, you know, 2,000 to 5,000 vehicles a year at the most. If you want to tool up to the level which would really get the price down and put this in people's garages at $50,000, you really have to put the kind of money in that you put in when you build a new type of car at Detroit, and that, you know, that could be in the area of $500 million to $1 billion, perhaps even higher. Still, that's a small amount of money in today's world. There are many billionaires in America, obviously, that could, they could fund that if they had the future view to do so.
Yeah, truly, you're correct. I mean, God, you've already spent $200 million. So for $100 million, you're saying you could knock out some number of them at about $250,000 a copy, right? There are plenty of people with that kind of money in America who would buy one. Now, that vehicle, I presume, would not be on these pre-done highways that you're talking about, or would they?
No, because the numbers wouldn't be there. You know, the system is driven, the highway system is driven by the number of vehicles. We have this marvelous highway system in America developed to take on cars. And, of course, because the highway system is there, we build a lot more cars to use it. So it's a catch-22 problem. It grows together. The infrastructure and the number of vehicles grow together. But $250,000 and 10,000 vehicles a year in a few years would add up to a lot. We have the view that what we're going to do is we're going to do with our engine, much like we did with our muffler system, we're going to make it a worldwide product the plans are to build almost 3 million engines a year within 2 years of production. That's 250 million dollars a year if those engines were in production at that level for things like motor scooters and motorcycles in the Far East, where emissions are a big problem. Perhaps here at home, the kind of engine that would go in a snowmobile and get rid of the two-stroke engine there.
I'm here to tell you, Paul. I'm in Manila here in the Philippines, and we've got problems. Bangkok has problems. China has problems. Here in Asia, as you just mentioned, it's a gigantic problem. So something has got to be done, and it's got to be done soon, or the world is going to sink itself, quite literally.
You're absolutely right. And what's marvelous about the rotary engine, which our engine is clearly a derivative of, is it only has two moving parts. Even the two-stroke engine, which is the polluting master of the world right now, has three moving parts, and a four-stroke engine, a four-stroke piston engine, which can do what our engine does, has something like 50-some moving parts. And, of course, in a country that's developing, they need an inexpensive engine that is non-polluting, and we have that engine. And so we think this engine is going to be, we're going to be able to fund the sky car with our engine development. I have absolutely no doubt about that. It'll take us a little longer than it would be if somebody came forward and gave us $1 billion tomorrow or even $100 million. But we built $200 million in muffler product. We can build a couple billion dollars in engines in a fairly short period of time.
You bet. Question from a listener. If you fly at 25,000 feet, 25,000 feet, of course, is going to require the occupants have some sort of oxygen, right?
Well, pressurization of the vehicle. That's not as strange as it seems. You know, you can buy a home-built airplane today that have pressurization in them. Composite airplanes, the same kind of construction as we use. So Lance Air builds a what they call the 400P, which is a home-built aircraft that's pressurized. So it's not it's not as far-fetched as one might think, but it is a requirement, clearly.
Mm-hmm. So pressurization would not be a problem?
No.
Okay. As you go forward, which is bigger in the picture, the unmanned vehicle right now, the military vehicle, or is the four-man or four-person man vehicle much farther down the line?
I wouldn't say the manned vehicle is much farther down the line. I think that the immediate vehicles will be unmanned, and the reason that is, it's not a necessary factor, but it's a practical factor, because people can envision why these vehicles can be, our unmanned vehicles can be used for a number of things. For example, we have a contract from the California Highway System to build an unmanned vehicle for bridge inspection, one that can go up underneath the bridge and look for cracks, and there clearly are a number of cracks there. Mm. So we think there's a number of applications like that that are immediate that we will continue to pursue, but if money were available, there's no reason why the manned vehicle can't go forward just as fast. It's just that it seems to be much more acceptable in the minds of most of the business people who might be interested in our technology to start with unmanned vehicles.
Well, it seems to me that our car market has been sort of snatched away from us by the Japanese to a large degree. And it seems to me that if we were to proceed, if America got off its stuff and proceeded with something like your sky car, we could snatch that market right out from under them, couldn't we?
I absolutely agree. I think to some extent, it's a bit of a shame, I suppose, that we have to go to Eastern Europe to produce our engine. That's a fact. The economic cost of producing engines in America is too high. But we still can produce airplanes. Boeing produces airplanes competitively in the world's market, so we still have that market. And I hope to God we don't lose that like we lost the automotive market simply because we're not paying attention.
Well, I hope not too, but there are signs that that may be just around the corner. So I'm very concerned, and America should still be leading the way in this sort of development. And the sky car is not just my dream, but many people's dream out there. Paul, and obviously yours. You're getting on in age. How old are you now?
I'm getting close to 70. Fortunately, I still do a lot of things to try and slow down the aging process, because I became aware that this is going to take longer than I planned. So I'm doing a lot of, watching my diet, doing a lot of exercise, and keeping in shape. I expect to live over 100, because that's the way I want to be around to enjoy this.
Is it going to have to go that far? Are you going to have to live to be over 100 to see the four-person vehicle become a reality?
No. I'm just like to enjoy it for a few decades after I've got it out there.
I hear that. Well, it must be. How long have you been working on this in total now?
Well, I started. I designed my first helicopter when I was 15 and started building that in that time period, and that's obviously 55 years ago. So, or close to 55 years ago. So I've been working on it ever since then. To some degree, I got much more aggressive in the early 20s when I took a teaching position here in California. In my mid-20s, I started building. I got the biggest garage in the local community with a little house attached to it. And that's where I started actually building the vehicles themselves. And I've been pursuing it both theoretically and practically ever since then. But engines have become the stumbling block. You need a large amount of power in a small package, mm-hmm. and I never had that really. Even the Mazda engine that you referred to in your car was still quite a bit heavier than necessary to make this thing fly.
Sure. So the engine is the key to the whole thing, and you say you can get them produced in Eastern Europe. What is the engine that you've got in the test vehicle that you've got now?
This is an engine that we developed, and of course, this is the engine that's being, that's going to be manufactured in Eastern Europe. It's a very small engine. We have actually models small enough you could hold in your palm of your hand to put out 2 horsepower.
Wow.
We have engines the size of a bucket to put out 150 horsepower, and we have engines the size of, maybe 2 feet long and a foot in diameter to put out 300 horsepower.
Wow. It seems to me that even current traditional U.S. car companies ought to be interested in what you just said.
Well, if we thought we would get a hearing, we would certainly approach them. But based upon just observations, I'm not very optimistic. Most of my positive reception has come from companies like Toyota and Honda, although in all fairness, Ford did take a serious look at what we're doing at one point a few years ago.
Huh. So the Japanese car companies, though, have probably taken the most intense look.
Absolutely. Toyota seems to look at everything. I mean, they really are on top of... They're even building airplanes out there, and Honda's coming out with a new airplane, a small microjet aircraft. So the car companies are looking at aircraft, not necessarily my type of aircraft for sure, but the fact that the car companies are going in the aircraft direction is a sign that the future is going to change.
Well, what's happened to our car companies in America? Why are they not forward-looking as they once were?
Well, big companies become kind of complacent over a period of time. For the Japanese to compete here, they had to offer something special, and they tended to offer initially fairly small, inexpensive cars that were reliable. And building on that reputation and continuing to keep that reputation allows them to build cars in America, Toyota and Honda, that are reliable with American manpower at economic prices compared to Detroit. I don't have a direct answer other than the fact that I've seen myself many big companies that went south because of the complacency of being the top dog.
So you began, give me a rough idea of when you began the actual Sky Car concept. Of where in your life did that start?
When I was doing my PhD at McGill University, not as part of my PhD, but as a, like everybody needs a hobby when they're doing a PhD, but in any case, I loved vertical takeoff aircraft so much that I ended up in the evening working on a model of an aircraft, which we called the XM-2, and we called the model XM-1, but it was a scale model of the first one that I built in my garage in 1964 and 65. and flew it at the University Airport. And actually, it got quite a bit of publicity. It was shown Walter Cronkite on CBS and other things as we flew around the University Airport at 3 or 4 feet off the ground. But it wasn't a stable aircraft. It, if you tried to go any higher than that, you would have crashed because you needed artificial stabilization when you were near the ground, and that was the limitation. That took us, you know, that took about $25 million and about 15 years to get a system that would fly the aircraft for itself.
What prevents now, in your opinion, what prevents a sizable investment, the additional $100 million or a lot more that you need to make this practical? What's preventing that? What's stopping these companies? When they come take a look, there must be something, some hole in this whole idea that's stopping them from forking over the money.
Well, first off, I don't know how seriously they really do consider it even to start with. I think they're, you know, checking out technologies. They think of themselves as car companies for the most part, so how serious they are, I don't know. But assuming they had some serious interest in it, they would certainly be concerned with the fact that the government is involved in the approval process, because that is a, you know, theoretically a lengthy process, the FAA certification. But in all fairness, if I'm going to take their side of the issue, I'd have to say that historically aircraft, because they've been built in small numbers historically, have not made much money, nor has engines for aircraft made much money, because the numbers have been small. And unless you have this vision that this can be large and we can produce a huge number of these aircraft, it makes them very nervous in that, in fact, the numbers would be small. I think any major breakthrough, and paradigm-shifting kind of breakthrough, is going to have a lot of resistance because of its difficulty in predicting the future. And big companies don't tend to be very futuristic.
No, no, they don't. I suppose not. Is there any chance that you could cobble together a version of perhaps even with the vehicle that you have now that would demonstrate horizontal flight as well as vertical flight? I assume that you still have only done your vertical flight in a tethered fashion. Is that correct?
That's correct. But the main reason for that is the engines we were using up until recently were very limited in their power. But we have made a fairly major breakthrough in the amount of power we're getting out of the engine. And we're installing 8 much more powerful engines. The previous engines had about 65 horsepower each, and we're putting in 8 engines that have 120 horsepower each. They fit in the same space, and this would really allow us the extra power in case we lost a number of engines or just the ability to control becomes a lot easier if you have excess power. And we're also building a lake, a fairly sizable lake, over which we can do low-speed flights, not high-speed flights, because high-speed flights you definitely go up to altitude to do. But low-speed flights in an area untethered where the press could observe them. And we have actually over 1,000 sign-ups by the press to attend a flight next spring when we do this.
Oh! This will occur next spring.
We believe it will. We've got enough things going right now. Most of the tooling is complete for the new engine installation. We have the engines almost completely assembled. We have started the lake as a project to have complete in the next few months. And so once the weather clears in the spring, I believe we'll be in a position to give a demonstration that would be safe and at the same time show the full capabilities, short of conversion to full aerodynamic flight.
Mm-hmm.
Where
are you building this lake?
We're building it at a commercial complex, one of my real estate projects that keep me alive in life, called the Melk Farm in Northern California. It's quite a famous commercial site many, many years ago, and I'm resurrecting it. And as part of that, I'm building a lake, which would be part of the commercial complex. And I will use that at least initially for my test flights.
I see. Well, then you are making progress.
For anybody's interest, they could look up melkfarm.net and they can read about the site where the lake is going to be and where we'd be doing our test flying.
People are very, Paul, people are very, what's the right word, impatient, you know, and They hear about something like this, and then the next thing they want to hear is that they can go out and buy one. And, of course, as you've pointed out, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of investment here and some not very forward-looking companies, and you're just doing this on your own. So, like many pioneers, it is possible, Paul, that you may not see this come to fruition in your lifetime. I guess that's occurred to you.
Well, no, actually it hasn't.
Well, you're an optimist.
No, if I wasn't an optimist, I wouldn't be here. But everything that I've done has generally taken longer than I planned. But certainly when we set out to develop an engine that we've now completed that has a world market, we succeeded. When we went into the muffler business, we became the dominant manufacturer of these kind of products in the world. I am sure we're going to be successful to some level. Now, will I see this as a replacement for the automobile? I don't think so, not in my lifetime, but as a vehicle that can replace about 40% of the miles we travel today on the highway, which is 50 miles and more, I say absolutely.
All right. Well, Paul, hold it right there. We're at a break point from the Philippines. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Indeed, here I am. My guest is Paul Mahler. He is the Sky Car, Paul Mahler, and he's been working on it for years. It's been his dream. What I want to do is a segment, a 30-minute segment, and take questions from all of you in the audience. So if you have a question about the Sky Car, its progress, where it's eventually going to go and how it's going to get there, pick up a telephone and join us now, and I'll get you on the air with Paul Mahler. For me, it's a dream. I don't know. I guess I've had this dream of personal flight, and I know I'm not alone. Here's a man working on it, now 70 years old. I guess we've been doing interviews now for about the past, 8 or 10 years. Maybe Paul can fill me in on that. And we can all only hope that the Sky Car will become reality. Paul Mahler, and your chance to speak with him in a moment. Once again, Paul Mahler. As I said, we'll do a segment here and take questions from all of you about the Sky Car and its progress, or in the view of some, its lack of progress. But Paul is one man, and I guess he's about $200 million into this project right now to get a car that would work and would sell for about $250,000. Expensive, but hey, for those with a dream, I think a lot of people would be willing to fork it over. It would take about another $100 million. So, Paul, if you're there, I'd like to take some questions from the audience.
Sure.
Great. Okay, here we go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Paul Mahler.
Hello. Hello, Mr. Bell. Hello, Mr. Mahler. I've been seeing stuff on the Internet about your car for ages, and it's so cool that you're doing this show. I'd just like to ask, you were discussing economic scale. Is it possible, and I know this may be a horribly, horribly stupid question because I'm not informed about the subject at all, is it possible to do mass transit vehicles? Because Boeing seems to be doing pretty well with their mass transit, and they make significantly more money if they can squeeze a few more people into the plane because they can sell it for more. So, like, would a bus be tenable or...
Okay, a Mahler...
No, it's not, but the idea here would be... flight on demand rather than schedule. So it's mass transportation, but at a more individual level. For example, you'd have probably six passenger type vehicles at the airport. When six people arrive, it leaves. When six more people arrive, it leaves. Mm-hmm. So that you're not on schedule, but you're on demand. And that's a form of mass transportation, but at a much more individual level. That's possible. Sky cars cannot be built big. The physics, the laws involved don't allow that to go beyond a certain point, but it still allows mass transportation the way I describe it.
Okay, well, that's all right. I a bus would be more like, you know, getting on a 767 or something like that anyway. Paul, I like the idea of the small Sky Car, and I guess you do too. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Paul Mahler. Hi.
Yes, sir. in the 60s already, there were people that were interested in a one-man helicopter, and you have these fine engines and these exotic computers. I think the one-man helicopter not only would be very feasible, but would pave the way for the national system, and the motorcycles around the world by the millions are one-man vehicles.
All right. Well, that is, a good question for Paul. Paul, because he did work on helicopters early on. Paul?
Well, a helicopter is, by nature, a very complicated machine with all the mechanics. It's often been described as a large number of parts flying in formation. There's a good reason for that. Tremendous amount of cost associated with all those mechanical parts, tremendous maintenance, difficult typically to fly even when stabilized. And that's one of the reasons we gave up the helicopter idea. I think that our engine would contribute to that field, but I don't think that the helicopter will go fast enough, for one thing. I think people want a really fundamental change in the speed above that of an automobile, and everybody seems to be going 80 miles an hour today, so I got to go faster than that. There's a number of reasons why the sky car is really the option if you really want a paradigm shift in transportation.
Oh, and I really do, too. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Paul Muller. Hi.
Hi, Art. Hi, Paul. I have a question, sort of a curiosity about the physics. I don't think it would be necessary for a sky car to ever do this because of all the different safety checks. I'm familiar with the sky car, but I am curious to know whether it would be capable of flaring out if it ever had to, though it probably would never have to.
When you say flare out, you're talking about whether it could be made to land in a conventional airport, for example?
Well, what I'm saying is, for example, if the engine absolutely quit, or all the backup engines quit, everything quit, the idea is when you're falling, using the apparent updraft due to your falling through space to power the fan as a windmill and get enough flywheel out of the rotor to then reverse the blades on it once again to get power just from inertia of the spin of the engine to make a powered landing in the last few moments.
Yes, you're talking about auto-rotation like the helicopter.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's not possible. But, you know, even if auto-rotation of a helicopter is flying below 200 feet and hovering, it's called the dead man's corridor for a good reason. Even with auto-rotation, you're going to die. So what we've really done is we've built in, of course, redundancy in the number of engines and in the computers, plus we have on board parachutes so that if you can slow the thing down long enough to deploy the parachutes, then you have that option. But parachutes are not good for certainly under 100 feet. You really have to have this redundancy, this ability that you can tolerate failures.
Mm-hmm. Okay. First-time caller line. You're on the air with Paul Muller. Hi.
Hello. I just have two questions for Paul here. One question is, how would you be able to compete with the airlines, since the airlines are a hell of a lot cheaper? And the second question is, which is really concerning here, if it happened to get a hold, the terrorists actually got a hold of this, could be a very destructive weapon in the United States. It can hover, it can go over the White House or major cities.
All right, both are probably good questions. First of all, competition with the airlines, Paul.
Well, Boeing did an extensive study on our technology and concluded that, and this actually is available on the Internet, which if anybody checks with the company can find out the address, but they showed that it would be actually very competitive with a commercial business because of the basic low cost of burning fuel, for example. Jet airplanes, even though they carry a lot of people, still burn a lot of fuel per passenger. But, of course, in the very big airplanes that they're contemplating, no, we couldn't compete the latest, most efficient jet planes on that basis. But then again, you're giving up a lot. You're flying with a whole bunch of people, and you're going from point A to point B, which may not be where you want to go, but the only way to get there indirectly. With our vehicle, you can go personally from any small place to any other small place. And, of course, these very small jets that are coming about today, you may have heard about, like Eclipse, is going to try and help you do that. So there's a big market for that and the desire of people to go from point A to point B on their own schedule.
Okay, and the terrorist question.
Well, I think we have the best answer for terrorism there is, because if you have this organized highway in the sky where you know where every vehicle is precisely and why they're there, you won't get any surprises. People aren't going to appear from out of nowhere. First off, as I said, the vehicles are controlled from the ground rather than the air to start with. And so the terrorist, long before he gets into the controlled airspace, is going to be identified. And we're going to know everything about everybody. You may not like that concept, but that's going to be the nature of this world, because that's how we get people to go safely from one point to the other without running into one another. So
no,
I think
that's the way the world's going anyway. Yeah, it's going that way anyway. If you've taken an airplane flight lately, you know that. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Paul Mahler. Hi.
Oh, good evening, Art.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Wonderful to talk to you guys. I don't know if you touched on this before, but as far as the power for the motor, I've seen things about Honda. They are doing a home-type hydrogen system to where they could plug their cars in for hydrogen. Do you guys have any kind of plans for motors that would run on hydrogen? I'd like your input on that. Thank you.
Well, the rotary engine has been run on hydrogen, but the infrastructure of hydrogen is 15 years away. We could convert to ethanol tomorrow because we could take out the high octane pump and put in a ethanol, which is even a higher octane, and we could have ethanol in every available to everybody almost tomorrow. Hydrogen is at least 15 years away just because of the infrastructure, but hydrogen does work in the rotary engine.
Okay, good enough. East of the Rockies, your turn with Paul Mahler. Hi.
Hello, Art. It's Rob out in Albuquerque, the home of that Eclipse Aviation jet that your guest was mentioning. I see it fly around here all the time. Even that thing's like a $1.5 million now. But question for your guest is, as an aircraft owner, he's, proposing that this is all going to be under electronic flight rules, which would mean that in order for me to fly my little Cessna in the airspace that currently exists with this vertical takeoff and landing sky car he's talking about, I have to upgrade my little Cessna with probably $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 worth of avionics, so that we don't fly into each other. Because obviously, the person flying the vehicle won't be a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the only thing we have to do is protect ourselves or protect you from going into this. Controlled airspace, specifically controlled virtual highway in the sky. And, of course, one of the reasons your systems would cost $40,000 is because we've reduced very few of them. But the ABS-B system, which gives you a very good sense of who's around you and why they're there, is going to be very inexpensive. The TCAS, which is one that you may be aware of, that's pretty expensive. It wouldn't be something that could go in immediately. But if we have huge volumes, that would be additional support for you that would assure that you could operate the way you want and still coexist with this highway in the sky that I'm talking about.
And Paul, what would be the impact on commercial aviation?
Well, I think it would be a very complementary approach, because, you know, if you want to go long distances, the jet airliners are still the way to go. And as the guest earlier mentioned, when it gets to these large airplanes they're contemplating, there's nobody that can compete with that in terms of passenger miles per gallon of fuel. But if you want to go these short distances, jet planes are not very efficient. So much of the fuel is used taking off and landing and climbing that they become very uneconomic. So I think that there's a very complementary role it can fill. It'll offload airports because we don't need to have runways. And, of course, airports are running out of space today, and there are no new major airports planned in America. So I don't know where we're going to be 10 years from now for aircraft flight. We really need something like this that complements some of the auto industry and complements some of the aircraft industry. And, quite frankly, if I didn't do it, it would happen anyhow. It's inevitable.
All right. First time, make that wild card line. You're on the air with Paul Mahler. Hi.
Hi, George from over in Pennsylvania.
Hi, George.
Dr. Miller, your vehicle is with the 8 motors. It's just a fantastic, and you have so much control. How come, though you use the, gasoline or whatever, that you haven't thought about the lifter over unity type motors that do exist, that you would have gimbalized?
Which over unity motor is that?
Well, the over unity motor of any... what they call an outside-type motor, say, in England for refrigerators, and configure it and free it flies and it gets up in the air, and it's just a matter of spinning, which is what he has on his craft. And
I'm not familiar with any over unity motor.
Very good. John R. Cyril.
Mm-hmm.
He has an
All right. Well, we'll certainly
published in you know, on the net and everything.
Published on the net. Okay. Well, Paul, what he's talking about, you know what over unity is, don't you?
I'm familiar with what he's talking about, but the fact of the matter is I've never seen one of these work in front of me, and I think something like this may eventually come, but I don't think the physics is there yet. That's just my impression.
Actually, the physics totally argues with it all the way. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Paul Mahler. Hi. Hello.
Good evening, sir. This is Mike from West Palm, Florida.
Yes.
And yes, my question for Dr. Mahler is, has the government even expressed any interest in the vehicle? Because the potential I see is this would be a very good first responder vehicle.
Yes, the government is very interested for a medevac vehicle and a logistics vehicle, but a government typically does not give contracts to companies our size simply because there's a lot of reasons why a company our size might be a liability. We may not, you know, be big enough to do the job. So it really looks to us to find a partner, and that's what we've done in the past. When we have contracts that come up, we go out and join forces with other companies, such as Pratt & Whitney or a number of other companies I could name, which we've worked with, to do it together, because they have a presence in Washington, and that's what we're doing right now.
All right, good enough. East of the Rockies, your turn with Paul Mahler. Hi.
Yes, Dr. Mahler. Last time you were on with Mr. Bell, you were still having difficulties with the software control to some extent. You had it hovering, but for forward flight, I don't think you, if I remember correctly, had it all the way worked out. Are you still working on that? Are you using auto-generating software? I'm just curious.
We've come a long way since we last talked to you, mostly in the area of redundancy, because while we were redundant when we talked, we didn't really have as redundant a system. You could find areas where a failure could have brought down the aircraft. And so we've spent probably 3 years now building that system to a much higher level of reliability. And while we haven't tested it any significant flights forward, we certainly have simulated in detail, which is where you start off and when you're checking something in any case. So
And of course, the ethanol breakthrough is gigantic, so.
Yes, absolutely. It's really, well, first off, if something goes wrong, ethanol is so much safer in so many ways.
Yeah, a good point. First time caller line, you're on the air with Paul Mahler. Hi.
Hi. Is it Vernon from Costa Mesa?
Yes.
A question about, I'm handicapped and I have hand control. Are these vehicles going to have hand controls for the handicap?
The vehicles are entirely hand control. I don't think that using your feet to steer like a light plane is a natural thing in the first place. We've had some bad experiences with untrained people in some of our simulators when we tried to use that initially. So everything is hand controls. Your feet are not used at all for anything, including braking or anything else. So I think this would be the perfect vehicle for someone who only has hand control.
Well, it truly would. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Paul Mahler. Hi.
Yes, hello. I'm Donald from Eureka, Illinois, and
yes.
I was wondering if he's building these by himself, and if so, does he need help?
Well, when myself, of course, in no way do I have the skill to be an expert electronics designer, either hardware or software, nor am I an expert composite man. So, of course, we're a public company. We have a large number of stockholders. We have a fairly high market capitalization. And so, really, we're dealing with a lot of skilled people involved to make this happen. Not enough, I would say, as I would certainly like to add a few hundred more to our company. But we would certainly, at the same time, if we're the skilled people out there, we're always looking for them. And they can look at our internet site and they can see the kind of people we're trying to have join us.
Okay, and of course, we've got a link to your internet site on coasttocoastam.com right now. Paul, what do you need most? Is the answer money?
Well,
It's money, but it really is money and a relationship as well, because, as I said, money alone, I'm not at this stage of my life planning to create another General Motors. Sure. I want to see this project a success, and I'm going to make it a success by joining forces with the right partner when we've decided who that should be.
Okay, so that process is still underway. Well, listen, Paul, I want to thank you for updating us on what you're doing. And you're obviously a pioneer. You're a great guy, and we'll have you back again as each step comes along. Paul, I hope you'll take the chance to think of us and update us with where the Sky Car is.
Yes, you might mention to somebody, they can just put Sky Car on any search engine on the internet, and they're going to find an enormous number of things they can read about. Sky Car alone is enough to get them anything they want to see.
Sky Car on Google, and you're there. All right, Paul Mahler, thank you, buddy. Take care.
Thank you. It's good talking to you again, Art.
Good night. And when we come back, we will go into 1 hour of absolute undiluted open lines. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. I wonder if some of you remember that very, very nice lady who called from Canada, actually for a couple of consecutive weeks. Well, she said she was coming to the Philippines, and indeed she did, and she wants to shout out to her husband, Tom. So, Tom, up in Canada, hi, buddy. We're about to rock and roll into some open lines, but there is something, since we got an update from Paul Mahler, that I'd like to do here in a moment. It concerns flying. As you know, many of you may know, I'm a Lutheran, so I guess I can read this. Somebody sent this to me, and I thought it was funny. We are pleased to announce Lutheran Air is now operating in Minnesota, also serving Wisconsin, North, and South Dakota. If you're traveling soon, consider Lutheran Air. Lutheran Air, the no-frills airline. You're all in the same boat on Lutheran Air, where flying is an uplifting experience. There's no first class on any Lutheran Air flight. Meals are potluck. Rows 1 through 6 bring rolls. 7 through 15 bring a salad. 16 through 21 main dish, and 22 through 30 dessert. Bases and tenors, please sit in the rear of the aircraft. Everybody is responsible for his or her own luggage. All fares are by free will offering, and the plane will not land till the budget is met. Pay attention to your flight attendant, who will acquaint you with the safety system aboard Lutheran Air Flight 599. Okay, listen up. I'm only going to say this once. In the event of the sudden loss of cabin pressure, I'm frankly going to be real surprised, and so will Captain Olson, because we fly around 2,000 feet. So loss of cabin pressure would probably mean the second coming or something of that nature. I wouldn't bother with those little masks, those little rubber tubes. You're going to have much bigger things to worry about than that. Just stuff those back in the little holes there. Probably the masks fell out because of turbulence, to which, to be honest with you, since we're flying at 2,000 feet, we'll have quite a bit of. Sort of like driving across a plowed field, but after a while, you get used to it. In the event of a water landing, I'd say forget it. Start saying the Lord's Prayer. Just hope you get to the part about forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us, which some people say is trespass against us, which isn't right, but what can you do? The use of cell phones on the plane is strictly forbidden, not because they may confuse the plane's navigation system, which is a seat of the pants all the way anyway. No. It's because cell phones are a pain in the wazoo. And if God meant you to have a cell phone, he'd have put one on your mouth on the other side of your head. We start lunch right after noon. It's buffet style with a coffee pot up front. Then we have the hymn sing. Hymnals are in the seat pocket in front of you. Don't take yours with you when you go. I'm going to be real upset, and I'm not kidding. Right now, I'll say grace. Come, Lord Jesus, be our guest, and let these gifts to us be blessed. Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, may we land in Duluth or something pretty close. I don't know who sent that to me, but thank you. And I have something extra special for you, including open lines, coming up in a moment. We're going to open lines here shortly, so feel free to grab a line and join it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Open lines.
Hey, I just wanted to, well, first of all, I wanted to say I love you, man. You are just super huge out here in New Mexico, you and George both.
Well,
and I would love to see you guys do some sort of like live show or something like that, maybe on the
well, what do you think we're doing here? That's what we're doing. It's all live. It's
well,
live
know,
radio. You know how much
been.
Do you know how much live is left in the world? Almost everything is taped. There are very few live shows left of any kind on television or radio.
Yeah, it's amazing. Anyway, first of all, very concerned for your safety down there with any kind of death threats, because I think you and I both know that life is fairly cheap down in the Philippines, and money buys everything, and it doesn't take that much.
Well, I wouldn't deny any of that. I do have some level of concern right now. I thought by now this stupid, godforsaken, stupid letter would have died, but it's making another circulation around the internet, and there is one thing that goes on here in the Philippines. Media people are frequently offed, as it were, and because of the nature of this particular letter and the fact that it's now going around again, there is some concern. So,
it's unbelievable.
You know, but on the other hand, you only live once, so
yeah.
Live big.
Hey, just another question here, because I know things are fairly cheap there. Do you guys have a maid that takes care of all the house cleaning and all that too?
No. We live in a condo, and we have a maid's quarters here in our condo.
Wow.
The one I bought. But A, my wife doesn't want a maid. B, then she wouldn't have much to do. She really likes doing it herself. And so the answer is we have maid's quarters, but we don't have a maid. That's it. So we just use it for, I don't know, washing, and we even have a maid's bathroom, or a comfort room, as they're called here. But no, we don't have a maid. But to give you some idea of the cost, if we did have a maid, it's about $30 to $40 at the most a month for a live-in maid.
Unreal. Yeah, I know there's, about 50 to 100,000 Americans that are living in the Philippines that are retired.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know what the number is, but there are quite a few of us.
Unreal.
Yeah,
I can't blame them, though, for those kind of prices.
It's an amazing... Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's an amazing place. They're wonderful people. You will not find on the face of the globe a happier people than the Filipino people. They're just naturally happy.
All right, Art. Thanks a lot, man. You guys just keep doing that great work. Don't give up, buddy. Remember, you mean a lot to all of us.
See you later. Yeah, it is an amazing place. It's absolutely an amazing place. Let's go to the wild card line and say, howdy, you're on the air.
Hello, Art. This is John from Long Island, New York.
How you doing?
I just have a couple of quick questions. Are you ever planning to move back to the United States? And the second question is, do you feel, besides that disturbing letter that you got, do you feel just as comfortable being in the Philippines you would in the United States here, back home?
Okay. Let's see. I'll try and answer both questions for you. You want to take it on the air?
Yeah.
I guess you do. Okay. All right. Let's see. Do I ever plan on going back to the U.S.? Well, yes, probably. Or no, possibly. I don't know. I really have not thought that far ahead yet. I did buy the condominium here in Manila, and I absolutely love it. And I'm here because that's where Aaron is. And so, let's see. The second part, do I feel as comfortable here? Yes. I feel as comfortable here as I would anywhere else up until the time this letter began to circulate again. Now, it is dangerous. There's, I guess, no two ways about it. It is dangerous. So it's something that I'm going to have to think a little bit about. But I don't know. As I say, this is not one of those things that I'm not a runner. I don't run away from things. I sometimes run to them, but not away from them. So my inclination is not to run away from this, but I'm realistic, and so I do recognize the danger from this damn letter, and so it's something I'm thinking about. Will I ever come back? Yeah, maybe. Certainly there's a lot back there for me, and so we'll see. I would like very much for Erin to see the U.S. She is not one of those gals who particularly wants to live in the United States, but you know, one never knows. So who knows what the future holds? Let's go west of the Rockies and say, howdy, you're on the air. Hello?
Yes, hello?
Hello.
Hi, Art. Hi, I'm in Sedona, Arizona. I just wanted to tell you that I've been enjoying your voice on the Prey video game.
Yeah, that really surprised a lot of people. I guess I didn't say a whole lot about the fact that I was going to be in a video game, but sure enough, I am in Prey, and I think it shocked and surprised a lot of people because I didn't say much about it.
Well, it sure surprised me. Especially
tell me. I don't have a copy of the game, so you tell me. I've been hearing good things about Prey. How is it?
Well, it's actually pretty fun. It's scary, and it's all about alien abduction, and I think it did a really good job.
Well, thank you so very much, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I guess it came as a surprise to you when my voice just popped out all of a sudden?
Yeah, it made the game all of a sudden that much more exciting to get to the next level so I can hear the next phase of what was going on.
All right. Well, you're not all the way through it yet, I take it.
No, I'm about halfway through, but still on the alien ship, and it's quite a pleasure.
All right. Well, listen, bless your heart. Thank you. Okay, well, what happened is, I don't know, it was probably about 6 months or so, maybe 7 months before I left the United States. I was contacted by a game maker who made a game called Prey, and they asked me if I wanted to be in it. And I said, sure, why not? It had to do with, as he just mentioned, alien abduction and that sort of thing. So I thought it would be a natural, and sure enough, they rolled in. And we put the voice tracks together quite quickly, and it was one of those things that was just naturally easy and naturally good. So if you're a video game player and you bump into something called Prey, I believe that's P-R-E-Y, you'll hear my voice. Wildcard Line, you are on the air. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Art. Do you recall a show you did a few years ago about a mysterious returning radio signal, which was broadcast at one point and then returned, the signal returned full strength to Earth some 15 hours later. I don't remember the exact interval, but it was sometime after the signal was broadcast, it returned to Earth full strength.
I've actually experienced that myself.
Right.
What you're talking about is called long delay echo, LDE.
Right.
Nobody
right.
understands how it's occurring, why it's occurring. There are no physics that will explain what's happening. But I can tell you, it's as real as a heart attack. I've had it happen to myself.
Mm-hmm. And my theory is that perhaps if the interval is, let's say, for argument's sake, 15 hours, that at 7.5 hours, 7.5 light hours distance from the Earth, there exists some sort of phenomenon which bounces the signal back and acts in a similar way. As the signal was full strength when it came back, it has certain similarities or certain same physical properties as gray line propagation.
I guess that might be true. The whole thing of LDEs is difficult, if not impossible, to explain. The laws of physics simply don't allow it. Radio travels at the speed of light. And so any sort of several second or greater delay is simply impossible. It's simply impossible. It could not be accounted for by bouncing off the moon, which is unlikely at the shortwave frequencies anyway, which are reflected by the ionosphere. And so short of the moon, certainly nothing is going to come back full strength from any of our planets or anything of that order or note. So it's completely inexplicable, but I've had a lot of friends, amateur radio operators, who have experienced many, many, many seconds of delay, even up to a minute and more. I don't know about all the hours he was talking about, but even up to a minute is simply every bit as inexplicable as 15 hours would be. Where is that signal going? How is it coming back? We have tested it six ways from Sunday, and I'm telling you, it is a truth that cannot be explained by any sort of conventional anything. It's amazing. East of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Hey, Art, this is John from Springfield, Illinois.
Yes, sir.
Talked to you a couple weeks ago about the oil spill in the Philippines. I just wanted you to know that wasn't a joke. That was a true story. I was just kidding about
this. Listen, you're talking about the hair, right?
Yes.
Oh, man, I know you're absolutely right. I was at a local restaurant talking to my wife about this. After the program, I mentioned to her what you said, and she said, oh, yeah, that's absolutely right. They're collecting hair. But she said the problem is all this hair is being sent to the Philippine government, and the Philippine government isn't sure what to do with it.
Right.
I can imagine this comment. Giant pile of hair.
Well, the 11,000 inmates that all shipped their hair too. I guess they were giving away free haircuts. I didn't know how they were going to collect their hair either. Evidently, I saw something that NASA did a study on that too, and then the hair actually doesn't absorb it. It just, the oil clings to it.
Or maybe it's used to kind of corral the oil. I'm not really sure. And apparently the Philippine government isn't sure either. So they must have this giant stock of hair somewhere. I don't know.
And I got something to, all these 9/11 conspiracies. I think because there's no faith in the Bush government, I think everybody's too quick to accept all these outrageous theories. Well, what do you think about that?
Occam's razor. What seems most likely probably is. This is a big, important topic for me, sir. I appreciate the call. I refuse to believe, perhaps naively, that our own government would destroy the Trade Center buildings, Pentagon, try to destroy the White House. I don't for one second believe that. And perhaps that's a naive way to be, but I don't think so. I guess I have some lingering patriotic feeling about my government, about my presidents, whatever they may be. And we've had some difficult presidencies, right? Even at the worst, though, I don't think we've ever seen anything of this sort. And I don't think we've seen it now. I don't think for one second that our government orchestrated what happened on 9/11. I don't think our president did. I think that exactly what seems to have happened is what happened. And maybe that's showing my age. I'm 61 years old now. But I've always been a loyal American, and that's not changing now. Even though the people who do believe in these conspiracies are quick to point out that anybody who does not embrace the 9/11 conspiracy theories is a traitor. That's actually the kind of word they use all the time. Traitor. You are a traitor if you don't embrace this, if you don't think that the U.S. Did it all, that we wired extra explosives into the buildings to be sure that they went down. I think there have been enough people who have said that the amount of jet fuel, for example, that was carried by the planes was quite sufficient to begin to weaken the structure of the buildings. And, we could go on for a very long time about this, but I'm not going to. I simply will say that as an article of faith, I do not for one second believe that we destroyed our own buildings, that we crashed a plane into the Pentagon, that we sent one on its way toward the White House, that we did this ourselves. No, sir, I don't believe that. And whatever I may believe about our president, I certainly don't believe he would order something like that. So there you have it. Good morning, everybody. Afternoon or evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I happen to be in Manila, the Philippines. I'm Art Bell. Indeed, here I am, and I see many of you are there. We're in open lines, something I very, very much enjoy. So in a moment, we get right back to it. There may now be a medical explanation for shadow people. Now, I'll talk to you more about that tomorrow evening, but there's a certain segment of the medical community, scientific community, that believes they may have discovered a medical reason for what we call the shadow people. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, this is Greg.
We've got that part out of the way. Greg in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, this is Greg. Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. It was a couple of weeks ago on a Saturday night. I heard you talking about a military official that was discussing the
end result if we fail in our war on terror and how important it is. And I never caught the name of that general or whoever it was you were talking about.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll try and dig it out for you if I can. And I'm sorry, but it was quite a long piece. It took the best part of the first segment of the show to read it. And yes, it was about the war on terror and whether or not it could be lost or what losing the war on terror would actually mean. So I'll try and dig it out for you. I don't have the name offhand. First, make that wildcard line. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Art.
Yes.
Yeah. Good to get in for a change. The LDEs, there's another possibility, which I'm surprised you didn't think of, or maybe you did. Maybe there's somebody out there receiving our signals and deciding to say hi by repeating them back to us.
Well, of course that's a possibility. Look, we've tested these extensively. And what I mean by that is we've... I guess he meant alien. But I thought, well, okay, there's somebody out there recording and then quickly playing back in a number of seconds any given transmission. But that's not what's going on. Because we actually had people moving frequencies randomly in a way that nobody could possibly, and I mean nobody could possibly emulate. You just simply couldn't do it suddenly without warning. You're on a slightly different frequency. So it simply couldn't be done. Now, could aliens be doing it? Well, yes, I suppose so. That wouldn't be my first thought, however. Why simply send our own signals back to us? Although, when you think about it, it certainly would send a message, wouldn't it? So I guess there's nothing you can really rule out, but I would not think that that would be it. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. Great talk to you. I wonder if you could... would interview your wife?
Well, I sort of did. I think it was a week or two ago. I interviewed her about a creature here in the Philippines. You must have missed that.
Yes, I did. Must have been on a Sunday.
Could well have been, yes.
Yeah, I have to get up early on Monday, and Sundays are kind of out for me.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed her about a creature called the Aswang. You can hear that, I think, probably on the, you know, in the archives, if you have the archives available to you. But I would love to one day. Getting her to talk on the radio is not easy. She really doesn't want to. And that's most people, frankly. You know, you have to sort of drag them in here. So I did interview her briefly, and you can hear that in the archives. It would have been a Sunday or two Sundays ago, I think.
No, you know what? I did hear that, but what I was talking about, her life, you know, growing up and, you know, up to the time of, and including marrying you.
Okay. Well, you never know. Maybe I'll do that someday. She was born in a little place called Bukidon, and I'm slaughtering that. It's Bukidon. And I'm still slaughtering it. And that's on Mindanao, which is an island, a larger island to the south of here. And she is a teacher. She was teaching, actually, K, I think it was one through, now, let me see if I can get her in here. Hold on one sec. We'll see. What the heck? Why not? I have a quick question for you. You were teaching school, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What grades were you teaching?
Grade 1, and then grades 5 and 4.
So 1, 4, and 5.
Mm-hmm.
1, 4, and 5. Okay.
Yeah.
And you graduated from college, and then as a student, you were a student teacher. Uh-huh. Okay. Somebody just asked if I would interview you about your whole life. We don't have time to do that.
No.
Okay. Well, that's how hard it is to get her on the air, folks. She's a real sweetie. If you look at the webcam photo right now, you'll see a picture of her. And again, that was taken in Hong Kong during a trip we had a couple of weeks ago. So there you have it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, Art, how you doing?
Oh, just fine, sir.
Hey, I got two questions.
for you. I was just wondering if you're still doing the ham operation down there where you are.
I have. Yeah. Okay, the answer is I have all my ham gear here. And I'm in the process of getting the reciprocal licensing taken care of. And then I've got to approach the people here in the condominium building and see if I can get an antenna on the roof.
Oh, okay. And I was also going to wonder if I had to send you my email address, if you could send me that tequila. Dang,
that was a riot, wasn't it? Absolutely a riot. Yeah, I'll see what I can do. Send me your email address, okay?
Okay, and best wishes to you and your wife.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Thank you.
And by the way, if you want to reach me, I'm Art Bell, ArtBell at AOL.com or ArtBell at Mindspring.com. That's probably the better way to go. ArtBell at Mindspring, MindSpring. So that's ArtBell at Mindspring.com, and I depend on your articles, people sending relevant articles and things of interest, which I use in the beginning of the program. And so I'm depending on all of you to do, and I always have all these years to do research for me. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Art.
Hey.
Sam in Michigan.
Yes, sir.
I was wondering, Richard Rhodes of Nexus Magazine.
Uh-huh.
He interviewed, December 96, January 97, interviewed a Byron Wine, who's an engineer, and Byron Wine lists a whole array of high-mileage, patented high-mileage engine systems that would yield anywhere from 75 to, 400 miles per gallon. Mm. So I got on the telly, and I called a guy out in Boston who, Al Caggiano, fuel implosion vaporization system. He's an HVAC specialist, and he adapted and refined a evaporative coil for internal combustion, and he proved to Senator Kerry. In fact, he had three vehicles.
You know, I seem to remember something about that.
Yeah, in the annual 4th of July parade. And imagine a 72 Pontiac Catalina, 75 miles per gallon, a Mercedes 86 diesel, 162 miles per gallon, and a,
The obvious question here is, why aren't we all using it then?
Well, I called him, and this is 4 years ago, and he said, they're ready, they're going to be going into production, they're going to be built in Mexico, and he said, stay in touch, because I'll let you know, and send no money, I'll send them to you. Once you proved that they work, then you send the money. Well, I called him back, probably 9 months later, and disconnect. And then I heard an interview with Byron Wine last fall, and this man, Al Caggiano, wound up in China, and he's building them for the Chinese government over there.
Great, great. Oh, just great. All right, we'll see. People disappear, people end up elsewhere, people, all kinds of things seem to happen to people, but then we never get the product. And perhaps, as he just said, it'll just come sailing out of China one day, and there it will be. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hey, how you doing, Art?
Okay, sir.
I'm sorry to hear about your trouble over there. I hope it all blows over soon. I wanted to ask you if you've gotten a chance to get out and listen to any live music over in the Philippines. I'm a guitar player. I was wondering if...
the answer is absolutely yes. We went to a concert here just, 3 weeks ago, and we're going to the Bee Gees in November, so there's a lot of music here, buddy.
Yeah? Cool. All right, it's interesting. I got to check that out. Also, I was wondering how you're doing with the smoking thing, if you stayed quit or...
Okay.
Sore subject. You don't have to answer it. I understand.
No. I'll answer. I'm doing quite well. This is repetitive. I've cut down to about a tenth of what I've been smoking at all times, except when I'm on the air. Now, the radio bone, I can assure you, and radio people out there, you know this is true, is directly connected to the smoking bone. Now, I'm not a drinker, but I believe that anybody who drinks who goes to a bar will tell you that the drinking bone is connected to the smoking bone. Well, the radio bone is also every bit as much connected to the smoking bone as is the drinking bone. So when I'm on the air, I don't have an opportunity to chew gum. And that's what I've been doing otherwise, is chewing nicotine gum to try and cut down. So I would say I'm doing okay in view of how much I did smoke, which was almost all the time. I've done quite well, about a tenth of what I used to smoke. Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Hi, Art. This is Jessica from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Howdy.
Hi. I'm a convenience store clerk for a certain company with a letter in a circle. And a couple of years back, I guess two clerks got killed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now I've been seeing, like, that I'm working the midnight shift. I've been seeing shadows walk by the doors, and doors will open themselves, or cigarettes will appear on the counter when nobody's been there. It's starting to freak me out a little.
Well, I guess that's kind of a risky job you're in there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, luckily they've gotten it to where we can lock the doors and just serve out of a bulletproof glass window.
Hmm, bulletproof. That's nice.
It is real nice. But, yeah, so weird things have been going on, and I've been listening to you probably since I was about 15, and I'm just starting to get a little freaked out.
Well, I would say if it really is getting to you, it's time for a new career.
Oh, but I love it here.
Huh. Well, in that case, I don't know what to tell you. I guess you'll just have to follow your own conscience on this one, hon.
Well, I don't think they're, like, violent or anything. It's just they move things, and I'm like, where did that come from?
If it was me, which it's not, of course, I think that I would, if I'd seen enough of that, things moving on their own and all the rest of that, I'd probably move on. But then again, that's just me. Let's go here and say you're on the air, Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. Howdy.
Yeah, Art, how you doing? This is Tim in Salem, Missouri.
I'm fine, Tim.
I'd like to speak to you for a minute about, I think, one of your favorite subjects, EVPs.
Electronic voice
phenomenon.
It certainly is
now,
one of my favorite.
If I'm not mistaken, Art, the methodology that they use is basically to record silence and then play it back. Is this more or less how they go about it?
That's correct.
Okay. And I guess you're also familiar with the PEAR project out of Princeton University?
Very much so.
Okay. Have you considered that a tape recorder recording silence is recording random information? It's basically a random event or random information generator slash recorder.
I think that's fair, sure.
Okay, and some of the theories behind the Global Consciousness Project are that the human conscious global consciousness field can imprint on random events. So
Absolutely, my correct.
Question is isn't it possible that maybe we're not recording the dead, maybe we're recording the living?
Maybe, that's fascinating. That's absolutely possible.
Maybe what's happening is, just like the eggs from the Princeton Project, the random events of recording silence, we're actually picking up, it could be anything emotional, I would think. Obviously, that's just something that occurred to me. I'm not really sure specifically how we would go about testing such a theory. Obviously.
Nor am I, but I've got to say it's an absolutely fascinating theory. And next time that I have the EVP people on, mm-hmm. I'll run it by them.
Okay, that's an excellent thing. I'd be interested to hear what they have to say. Something else that occurs to me is along these lines, what about recording visual information? For example, what if you took a video camera
mm-hmm.
and you pointed it at your television screen? So not only are you recording information, but you're reinforcing an oscillating loop. So any information that comes in would be reinforced.
Cool idea.
I just thought I'd run that by Art. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That really is a cool idea. And he's absolutely right about the random nature of what it would be recorded, either digitally or with an analog machine, whether it would be audio or video, the possibility of an imprint by consciousness certainly can't be overlooked. And I wonder if that's something they've looked at Princeton. Wow. Depend on all of you out there. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
I had a question just about the It's more of a opinion question to ask of you, really. It has to do with the thought of extraterrestrials actually existing. Some experts have said that, you know, we are alone, or people have the opinion that we're alone on the Earth. Don't you think that for someone to think that is actually kind of an arrogant statement, considering the vastness of the universe?
I do, yes.
So, I mean, is it just people that are just being extremely narrow-minded about the possibility of, I mean, because...
I would say, yes, it's people being very narrow-minded. Yes, I agree with you.
But I was going to say, because there are so many different forms of life here, there are mammals, but, you know, between us and a lion or something else like that, I would think that, you know, the possibility of life here would exist in the same fashion someplace else.
Mm-hmm. We found life, sir, in the most unlikely places, at the bottom of the deepest part of the ocean, surrounding little volcanic vents called smokers. And I'm telling you, life is everywhere. So to make a statement that there is not life and that we are alone on Earth and alone in all that is not only arrogant, it's just plain stupid.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, and take care. And that's part of what this program is all about. West of the Rockies, you're on the air.
Hi, Art. This is Gary calling from Palm Springs, California.
Yes.
And I know you probably must be aware of all of the immigration talk that's been going on in the United States for quite
some time
now.
Yes, yes.
And my question for you is actually concerning the Philippines. I mean, it's so difficult for a Philippine national to get into the United States unless they're married to a U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Is it just as equally difficult for an American to get into the Philippines, or in your own case, was there any what kind of status did you get? Did you get a
okay? The answer to that is no. It is not, of course, as difficult. And I joined an organization here called the PRA. That's Papa Radio Alpha. You can look it up on the internet, and it allows me. I hold a little card, and it's not exactly a dual citizenship kind of deal, but it allows me to come and go as I wish from the Philippines. It's a permanent visa, or you could consider
like
it kind of like a
residence card.
It's kind of like a permanent residence card, and so I can come and go as I like without any visa problems. It's absolutely wonderful. I wish we had something very much like it going the other direction, but we don't.
Right.
So that's the answer to your question.
Okay, great. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care, friend, and take care, all of you. I will see you tomorrow, same time, same station is how I think the expression goes. And we're going to have a very, very, very good program for you tomorrow night. It's going to be a blast. So I suggest that you stay right where you are. We're going to be talking about what happens to people who commit suicide, you know, in the afterlife. That'll be tomorrow night. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. Have a good night. Good night, all.